Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Racism isn't just a word. Racism meaning white supremacy. Now, let me at this point, how many people are familiar with the book by T. Lothrop Stoddard? This is an old book. This came out in 1922.
What's the name of that?
Assignment class, everybody go and buy. The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. Yeah, the last page in the handout has a copy. But I don't know how many of you listen to Carl Nelson's radio show.
Yeah.
Now, some people have called in, oh, she's talking about white people aren't superior and white supremacy and whites are not supreme. Somebody might say, maybe mom's, well, why am I having all these troubles as a colored person if white is not supreme? Meaning, do people who classify themselves as white dominate the planet?
Yes.
If anybody, you know, anybody has some space where they don't dominate, tell me I want to go, and how do I get there? Do I have to get on an airplane or a boat? Who owns the airplanes and the boats? No, but this is a very important book. The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy first came out in 1922. He doesn't have any problem. He's almost like a Donald Trump in a way, but this is much more sophisticated than Trump. But talking clearly about the, you know, white domination has taken place. We have accomplished that. But we have to be aware that there are all these colored people. And we have to be aware if China should wake up. Well, China has wakened up. Now, he completely dismisses the Negro. You don't have to worry about the Negro is so far behind that you don't even need to worry or think about that. Do you see? But you do, we need to. We white people cannot, what? Act like we don't have to have concerns. See, they're not spending all their time singing and dancing. No, they spend their time. They have a few people that sing and dance, but they got a whole lot of people who are 24/7 serious. see, serious, working in three shifts of serious people in all areas of people activity. How do we maintain our position? Now, he interestingly talks about that white is the highest advancement of people. But he says, but they're, you know, we're vulnerable in that if we mix with any of the people, we can kind of get lost. And we can't have that happen. Do you see? But I say read Stoddard's book, read Neely Fuller, and then read the ISIS papers.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, October 28th, 2016, so I have been told. You just heard Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. That was at her final Welsing Institute lecture in December of 2015, where she strongly encouraged that her students read Mr. Lothrop Stoddard's The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. The book was originally published in 1990, and I was pretty sure that we were going to read this book at some point during the year, just number one, to pay homage to Dr. Welsing, but number two, not just to read something because, you know, Dr. Welsing said to check this book out and she was with us a few times. I am sure that Dr. Welsing, she would want us to really pay attention, have our brain computer alert, and really focus and see how we can apply the information in this text to what is happening right now, 2016, almost 2017, and how we can use this information to better understand our enemy, how to better solve this problem, replace white supremacy with justice. With that, we will go ahead and get started. Again, this is Lothrop Stoddard, a journalist, a Harvard-educated historian. He went to Nazi Germany and conducted interviews and wrote about his experience there. He wrote about the Haitian Revolution. He is one of the more prominent members of the 20th century eugenics movement at the beginning of the century. Really important white scholar, easily his most remembered, most researched, most notable text of the many that he wrote, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. Audio segment number one, our narrator is a Cows listener. We will go ahead and get started. Context of White Supremacy.
Introduction. Mr. Lothrop Stoddard's The Rising Tide of Color, following so closely the Great War, may appear to some unduly alarming, while others, as his thread of argument unrolls, may recoil at the logic of his deductions. In our present era of convulsive changes, a prophet must be bold indeed to predict anything more definite than a mere trend in events. But the study of the past is the one safe guide in forecasting the future. Mr. Stoddard takes up the white man's world and its potential enemies as they are today. A consideration of their early relations and of the history of the Nordic race since its first appearance 3,000 or 4,000 years ago tends strongly to sustain and justify his conclusions. For such a consideration, we must first turn to the map, or better, to the globe. Viewed in the light of geography and zoology, Europe west of Russia is but a peninsula of Asia, with the southern shores of the Mediterranean Sea included. True Africa, or rather Ethiopia, lies south of the Sahara Desert and has virtually no connection with the north except along the Valley of the Nile. This Eurasiatic continent has been, perhaps, since the origin of life itself, the most active center of evolution and radiation of the higher forms. Confining ourselves to the mammalian orders, we find that a majority of them have originated and developed there and have spread thence to the outlying land areas of the globe. All of the evidence points to the origin of the primates in Eurasia, and we have every reason to believe that this continent was also the scene of the early evolution of man from his anthropoid ancestors. The impulse that inaugurated the development of mankind seems to have had its basic cause in the stress of changing climatic conditions in Central Asia at the close of the Pliocene. And the human inhabitants of Eurasia have ever since exhibited a superlative degree of energy developed at that time. This energy, however, has not been equally shared by the various species of man, either extinct or living, and the survivors of the earlier races are, for the most part, to be found on the other continents and islands or the extreme outlying regions of Eurasia itself. In other words, those groups of mankind which at an early period found refuge in the Americas, in Australia, in Ethiopia, or in the islands of the sea, represent to a large extent stages in man's physical and cultural development, from which the more energized inhabitants of Eurasia have long since emerged. In some cases, as in Mexico and Peru, the outlying races developed in their isolation a limited culture of their own. But, for the most part, they have exhibited, and continue to this day to exhibit, a lack of capacity for sustained evolution from within, as well as a lack of capacity to adjust themselves of their own initiative to the rapid changes which modern times impose upon them from without. In Eurasia itself, this same inequality of potential capacity is found, but in a lesser degree. And consequently, in the progress of humanity, there has been constant friction between those who push forward and those who are unable to keep pace with changing conditions. Owing to these causes, the history of mankind has been that of a series of impulses from the Eurasiatic continent upon the outlying regions of the globe. But there has been an almost complete lack of reaction, either racial or cultural, from them upon the masses of mankind in Eurasia itself. There have been endless conflicts between the different sections of Eurasia, but neither Amerinds, nor Australoids, nor Negroes have ever made a concerted attack upon the great continent. Without attempting a scientific classification of the inhabitants of Eurasia, it is sufficient to describe the three main races. The first are the yellow-skinned, straight black-haired, black-eyed, round-skulled Mongols and Mongoloids, massed in Central and Eastern Asia, north of the Himalayan system. To the west of them, and merged with them, lie the Alpines, also characterized by dark but not straight hair, dark eyes, relatively short stature, and round skulls. These Alpines are thrust like a wedge into Europe between the Nordics and the Mediterraneans, with a tip that reaches the Atlantic Ocean. Those of Western Europe are derived from one or more very ancient waves of round-skulled invaders from the east, who probably came by way of Asia Minor and the Balkans. But they have been so long in their present homes that they retain little except their brachiocephalic skull shape to connect them with the Asiatic Mongols. South of the Himalayas and westward in a narrow belt to the Atlantic, and on both sides of the inland sea, lies the Mediterranean race, more or less swarthy-skinned, black-haired, dark-eyed, and long-skulled. On the northwest, grouped around the Baltic and North Seas, lie the great Nordic race. It is characterized by a fair white skin, wavy hair with a range of color from dark brown to flaxen, light eyes, tall stature, and long skulls. These races show other physical characteristics which are definite but difficult to describe, such as texture of skin and cast of features, especially of the nose. The contrast of mental and spiritual endowments is equally definite, but even more elusive of definition. It is with the action and interaction of these three groups, together with internal civil wars, that recorded history deals. While, so far as we know, these three races have occupied their present relative positions from the beginning, there have been profound changes in their distribution. The two essential phenomena, however, are first, the retreat of the Nordic race westward from the grasslands of Western Asia and Eastern Europe to the borders of the Atlantic, until it occupies a relatively small area on the periphery of Eurasia. The second phenomenon is of equal importance, namely the more or less thorough Nordicizing of the westernmost extensions of the other two races, namely the Mediterranean on the north coast of the inland sea, who have been completely Aryanized in speech and have been again and again saturated with Nordic blood, and the even more profound Nordicization in speech and in blood of the short, dark, round-skulled inhabitants of Central Europe, from Brittany through Central France, Southern Germany, and Northern Italy into Austrian and Balkan lands. So thorough has been this process that the Western Alpines have, at the present time, no separate race consciousness and are to be considered as wholly European. As to the Alpines of Eastern and Central Europe, the Slavs, the case is somewhat different. East of a line drawn from the Adriatic to the Baltic, the Nordicizing process has been far less perfect, although nearly complete as to speech, since all the Slavic languages are Aryan. Throughout the Slavic lands, great accessions of pure Mongoloid blood have been introduced within relatively recent centuries. East of this belt of imperfectly Nordicized Alpines, we reach the Asiatic Alpines, as yet entirely untouched by Western blood or culture. These groups merge into the Mongoloids of Eastern Asia. So we find, thrust westward from the heartland, a race touching the Atlantic at Brittany, thoroughly Asiatic and Mongoloid in the east, very imperfectly Nordicized in the center, and thoroughly Nordicized culturally in the far west of Europe, where it has become and must be accepted as an integral part of the white world. As to the great Nordic race, within relatively recent historic times, it occupied the grasslands north of the Black and Caspian Seas, eastward to the Himalayas. Traces of Nordic peoples in Central Asia are constantly found, and when archaeological research there becomes as intensive as in Europe, we shall be astonished to find how long, complete, and extended was their occupation of Western Asia. During the second millennium, before our era, successive waves of Nordics began to cross the Afghan passes into India, until finally they imposed their primitive Aryan language upon Hindustan and the countries lying to the east. All those regions lying northwest of the mountains appear to have been largely a white man's country at the time of Alexander the Great. In Turkestan, the newly discovered Tokharian language, an Aryan tongue of the Western Division, seems to have persisted down to the 9th century. The decline of the Nordics in these lands, however, began probably far earlier than Alexander's time, and must have been nearly completed at the beginning of our era. Such blonde traits are still found in Western Asia and are relatively unimportant. The impulse that drove the early Nordics like a fan over the Himalayan passes into India, the later Nordics southward into Mesopotamian lands as Kassites, Mitanni, and Persians, into Greece and Anatolia as Achaeans, Dorians, and Phrygians, westward as the Aryan-speaking invaders of Italy and as the Celtic vanguards of the Nordic race across the Rhine into Gaul, Spain, and Britain, may well have been caused by Mongoloid pressure from the heart of Central Asia. Of course, we have no actual knowledge of this, but the analogy to the history of later migrations is strong, and the conviction is growing among historians that the impulse that drove the Hellenic Nordics upon the early Aegean culture world was the same as that which later drove Germanic Nordics into the Roman Empire. North of the Caspian and Black Seas, the boundaries of Europe receded steadily before Asia for nearly 1,000 years after our era opened. But we have scant record of the struggles which resulted in the eviction of the Nordics from their homes in Russia, Poland, the Austrian and East German lands. By the time of Charlemagne, the white man's world was reduced to Scandinavia, Germany west of the Elbe, the British Isles, the Low Countries, and northern France and Italy, with outlying groups in southern Spain and France. This was the lowest ebb for the Nordics, and it was the crowning glory of Charlemagne's career that he not only turned back the flood, but began the organization of a series of more or less Nordicized marches, or barrier states, from the Baltic to the Adriatic, which have served as ramparts against Asiatic pressure from his day to ours. West of this line, the feudal states of medieval Europe developed into Western Christendom, the nucleus of the civilized world of today. South of the Caspian and Black Seas, after the first swarming of the Nordics over the mountains during the second millennium before Christ, the East pressed steadily against Europe until the strain culminated in the Persian Wars. The defeat of Asia in these wars resulted later in Alexander's conquest of Western Asia to the borders of India. Alexander's empire temporarily established Hellenic institutions throughout the western, and some of the provinces remained superficially Greek until they were incorporated in the Roman Empire and ultimately became part of early Christendom. On the whole, however, from the time of Alexander, the elimination of European blood, classic culture, and finally of Christianity went on relentlessly. By later Roman times, the Aryan language of the Persians, Parthians, and the people of India, together with some shred of Greek learning, were about all the traces of Europe that were to be found east of the oscillating boundary along the Euphrates. The Roman and Byzantine empires struggled for centuries to check the advancing tide of Asiatics, but Arab expansions under the impulse of the Mohammedan religion finally tore away all the eastern and southern coasts of the Mediterranean Sea, while from an Arabized Spain, they threatened Western Europe. With the white man's world thus rapidly receding in the south, a series of pure Mongol invasions from Central Asia, sweeping north of the Caspian and Black Seas, burst upon Central Europe. Attila and his Huns were the first to break through into Nordic lands as far as the plains of northern France. None of the later hordes were able to force their way so far into Nordic territories, but spent their strength upon the Alpines of the Balkans and Eastern Europe. Eastern Germany, the Austrian states, Poland, and Russia had been Nordic lands before the Slavs emerged after the fall of Rome. Whether the occupation of Teutonic lands by the Wends and Slavs in Eastern Europe was an infiltration or a conquest is not known, but the conviction is growing that, like other movements which preceded and followed, it was caused by Mongoloid pressure. That the Western Slavs, or Wends, had been long Nordicized in speech is indicated by the thoroughly Aryan character of the Slavic languages. They found in the lands they occupied an underlying Teutonic population. They cannot be regarded as the original owners of Poland, Bohemia, Silesia, or other Wendish provinces of Eastern Germany and Austria. The Teutonic Macromanni and Quadi were in Bohemia long before the Czechs came in through the Moravian Gate in the 6th century. Pomerania and the Prussias were the home of Teutonic Lombards, Burgunds, Vandals, and Suevi, while the Crimea and the northwestern coast of the Black Sea were long held by the Nordic Goths who, just before our eyes, had migrated overland from the Baltic by way of the Vistula. No doubt, some of this Nordic blood remained to ennoble the stock of the later invaders, but by the time of Charlemagne, in the greater part of Europe, east of the Elbe, the Aryan language was the only bond with Europe. When the Frankish Empire turned the tide and Christianized these Wendish and Polish lands, civilization was carried eastward until it met the Byzantine influences which brought to Russia and the lands east of the Carpathians the culture and Orthodox Christianity of the Eastern or Greek Empire. The nucleus of Russia was organized in the 9th century by Scandinavian Varangians, the Franks of the East, who founded the first civilized state among a welter of semi-Mongoloid tribes. How much Nordic blood they found in the territories which afterward became Russia, we have no means of knowing. But it must have been considerable, because we do know that from the Middle Ages to the present time, there has been a progressive increase in brachycephaly, or broad-headedness, to judge from the rise of the percentage of round skulls found in the cemeteries of Moscow and elsewhere in Russia. Such was the condition of Eastern Europe when a new and terrible series of Mongoloid invasions swept over it, this time directly from the center of Asia. The effect of these invasions was so profound and lasting that it may be well to consider briefly the condition of Eastern Europe after the elimination of the Nordics and its partial occupation by the so-called Slavs. Beginning with Attila and his Huns in the 4th century, there was a series of purely Mongoloid tribes entering from Asia in wave after wave. Similar waves ultimately passed south of the Black and Caspian Seas and were called Turks, but these were long held back by the power of the Byzantine Empire, to which history has done scant justice. In the north, these invaders, called in the later days Tatars, but all essentially of Central Asiatic Mongol stock, occupied Balkan lands after the expansion of the South Slavs in those countries. They are known by various names, but they are all part of the same general movement, although there was a gradual slowing down of the impulse. Prior to Genghis Khan, the later hordes did not reach quite as far west as the earlier ones. The first wave, Attila's Huns, were followed during the succeeding centuries by the Avars, the Bulgars, the Hunagar Magyars, the Patzinaks, and the Cumans. All of these tribes forced their way over the Carpathians and the Danube, and much of their blood, notably in that of the Bulgars and Magyars, is still to be found there. Most of them adopted Slavic dialects and merged in the surrounding population, but the Magyars retain their Asiatic speech to this day. Other Tatar and Mongoloid tribes settled in southern and eastern Russia. Chief among these were the Mongol Chazars, who found an extensive and powerful empire in southern and southeastern Russia as early as the 8th century. It is interesting to note that they accepted Judaism and became the ancestors of the majority of the Jews of Eastern Europe, the round-skulled Ashkenazim. Into this mixed population of Christianized Slavs and more or less Christianized and Slavized Mongols burst Genghis Khan with his great hordes of pure Mongols. All southern Russia, Poland, and Hungary collapsed before them, and in southern Russia, the rule of the Mongol persisted for centuries. In fact, the Golden Horde of Tatars retained control of the Crimea down to 1783. Many of these later Tatars had accepted Islam, but entire groups of them have retained their Asiatic speech and to this day profess the Mohammedan religion. The most lasting result of these Mongol invasions was that southern Poland and all the countries east and north of the Carpathians, including Romania and the Ukraine, were saturated anew with Tatar blood. And in dealing with these populations and with the new nations founded among them, this fact must not be forgotten. The conflict between East and the West, Europe and Asia, has thus lasted for centuries. In fact, it goes back to the Persian Wars and the long and doubtful duel between Rome and Parthia along the eastern boundary of Syria. As we have already said, the Caesarians had torn away many of the provinces of the Eastern Empire, and the Crusades, for a moment, had rolled back the East. But the event was not decided until Seljukian and Osmanali Turks accepted Islam. If these Turks had remained heathen, they might have invaded and conquered Asia Minor and the Balkan states, just as their cousins, the Tatars, had subjected the vast territories north of the Black Sea. But they could not have held their conquests permanently unless they had been able to incorporate the beaten natives into their own ranks through the proselytizing power of Islam. Even in Roman times, the Greek world had been steadily losing first its Nordic blood and then later the blood of its Nordicized European population, and it became in its declining years increasingly Asiatic until the final fall of Constantinople in 1453. Byzantium, once fallen, the Turks advanced unchecked, conquering the Alpine Slav kingdoms of the Balkans and menacing Christendom itself. In these age-long conflicts between Asia and Europe, the Crusades seem but an episode, although tragically wasteful of Nordic stock. The Nordic Frankish nobility of Western Europe squandered its blood for 200 years on the desert sands of Syria, and left no ethnic trace behind, save perhaps some doubtful blonde remnants in northern Syria and Edessa. If the predictions of Mr. Stoddard's book seem far-fetched, one has but to consider that 4 times since the fall of Rome, Asia has conquered to the very confines of Nordic Europe. The Nordicized Alpines of Eastern Europe and the Nordicized Mediterraneans of Southern Europe have proved too feeble to hold back the Asiatic hordes, Mongol or Saracen. It was not until the realms of pure Nordics were reached that the invaders turned back. This is shown by the fact that the Arabs had quickly mastered northern Africa and conquered Spain, where the Nordic Goths were too few in number to hold them back, while southern France, which was not them and is not now a Nordic land, had offered no serious resistance. It was not until the Arabs, in 732 at Tours, dashed themselves to pieces against the solid ranks of heavy-armed Nordics that Islam receded. The same fate had already been encountered by Attila and his Huns, who, after dominating Hungary and southern Germany and destroying the Burgundians on the Rhine, had pushed into northern France as far as Chalons. Here, in 376, he was beaten, but not by the Romanized Gauls, but by the Nordic Visigoths, whose king, Roderic, died on the field. These two victories, one against the Arab south and the other over the Mongoloid east, saved Nordic Europe, which was at that time shrunk into little more than a fringe on the sea coast. How slender the thread and how easily snapped had the event of either day turned out otherwise. Never again did Asia push so far west, but the danger was not finally removed until Charlemagne and his successors had organized the Western Empire. Christendom, however, had sore trials ahead when the successors of Genghis Khan destroyed Muscovy and Poland and devastated Eastern Europe. The victorious career of the Tatars was unchecked, from the Chinese Sea on the east to the Indian Ocean on the south, until in 1241, at Wasilat in Silesia, they encountered pure Nordic fighting men. Then the tide turned. Though outnumbering the Christians 5-1 and victorious in the battle itself, the Tatars were unable to push farther west and turn south into Hungary and other Alpine lands. Some conception of the almost unbelievable horrors that Western Europe escaped at this time may be gathered from the fate of the countries which fell before the irresistible rush of the Mongols, whose sole discernible motive seems to have been bloodlust. The destruction wrought in China, Central Asia, and Persia is almost beyond conception. In 12 years, in China and the neighboring states, Genghis Khan and his lieutenants slaughtered more than 18,500,000 human beings. After the sack of Merv in Khorasan, the Garden of Asia, the corpses numbered 1,300,000, and after Herat was taken, 1,600,000 are said to have perished. Similar fates befell every city of importance in Central Asia, and to this day, those once populous provinces have never been recovered. The cities of Russia and Poland were burned, their inhabitants tortured and massacred, with the consequence that progress was retarded for centuries. Almost in modern times, these same Mongoloid invaders, entering by way of Asia Minor and calling themselves the Turks, after destroying the Eastern Empire, the Balkan states, and Hungary, again met the Nordic chivalry of Western Europe under the walls of Vienna. In 1683, almost in modern times, these same Mongoloid invaders, entering by way of Asia Minor and calling themselves Turks, after destroying the Eastern Empire, the Balkan states, and Hungary, again met the Nordic chivalry of Western Europe under the walls of Vienna in 1683, and again the Asiatics went down in a rout. On these four separate occasions, the Nordic race and it alone saved modern civilization. The half-Nordicized lands to the south and to the east collapsed under the invasions. Unnumbered Nordic tribes, nameless and unsung, have been massacred or submerged or driven from their lands. The survivors had been pushed ever westward until their backs were against the northern ocean. There the Nordics came to bay. The tide was turned. Few stop to reflect that it was more than 60 years after the first American legislature sat at Jamestown, Virginia, that Asia finally abandoned the conquest of Europe. One of the chief results of forcing the Nordic race back to the seacoast was the creation of maritime power and its development to a degree never before known, even in the days of the Phoenicians and Carthaginians. With the recession of the Turkish flood, modern Europe emerges and inaugurates a counterattack on Asia, which has placed virtually the entire world under European domination. While in the medieval conflicts between Europe and Asia, the latter was the aggressor, the case was otherwise in the early wars between the Nordic and the Mediterranean peoples. Here, for 3,000 years, the Nordics were the aggressors, and although these wars were terribly destructive to their numbers, they were the medium through which classic civilization was introduced into Nordic lands. As to the ethnic consequences, northern barbarians poured over the passes of the Balkans, Alpines, and Pyrenees into the sunny lands of the south, only to slowly vanish in the languid environment which lacked the stimulus of fierce strife with hostile nature and savage rivals. Nevertheless, Long before the opening of the Christian era, the Alpines of Western Europe were thoroughly Nordicized, and in the centuries that followed, the old Nordic element in Spain, Italy, and France has been again and again strongly reinforced, so that these lands are now an integral part of the white world. In recent centuries, Russia was again superficially Nordicized with a top dressing of Nordic nobility, chiefly coming from the Baltic provinces. Along with this process, there was everywhere in Europe a resurgence among the submerged and forgotten Alpines and among the Mediterranean elements of the British Isles, while Bolshevism in Russia means the elimination of the Nordic aristocracy and the dominance of the half-Asiatic Slavic peasantry. All wars thus far discussed have been race wars of Europe against Asia, or of the Nordics against Mediterraneans. The wars against the Mongols were necessary and vital. There was no alternative except to fight to the finish. But the wars of Northern Europe against the South, from the racial point of view, were not only useless, but destructive. Bad as they were, however, they left untouched, to a large extent, the broad land of the race in the North and West. Another class of wars, however, has been absolutely deadly to the Nordic race. There must have been countless early struggles where one Nordic tribe attacked and exterminated its rival, such as the Trojan War, fought between Achaeans and Phrygians, both Nordics, while the later Peloponnesian War was a purely civil strife between Greeks and resulted in the racial collapse of Hellas. Rome, after she emerged triumphant from her struggle with the Carthaginians of Mediterranean race, plunged into a series of civil wars which ended in the complete elimination of the native Nordic element in Rome. Her conquests were destructive to the Nordic race. Particularly, so was that of Caesar in Gaul, one of the few exceptional cases where the North was permanently conquered by the South. The losses of that 10-year conquest fell more heavily upon the Nordic Celts in Gaul and Britain than on the servile strata of the population. In the same way, the Saxon conquest of England destroyed the Nordic Britons to a greater degree than the pre-Nordic Neolithic Mediterranean element. From that time on, all the wars of Europe, other than those against the Asiatics or Saracens, were essentially civil wars fought between peoples or leaders of Nordic blood. Medieval Europe was one long welter of Nordic immolation until the Wars of the Roses in England, the Hundred Years' War in the Lowlands, the religious, revolutionary, and Napoleonic Wars in France, and the ghastly Thirty Years' War in Germany, dangerously depleted the ruling Nordic race and paved the way for the emergence from obscurity of the servile races which for ages had been dominated by them. To what extent the present war has fostered this tendency, time alone will tell. But Mr. Stoddard has pointed out some of the immediate and visible results. The backbone of Western civilization is racially Nordic, the Alpines and Mediterraneans being effective precisely to the extent in which they have been Nordicized and vitalized. If this great race, with its capacity for leadership and fighting, should ultimately pass, with it would pass that which we call civilization. It would be succeeded by an unstable and bastardized population, where worth and merit would have no inherent right to leadership, and among which a new and darker age would blot out our racial inheritance. Such a catastrophe cannot threaten if the Nordic race will gather itself together in time, shake off the shackles of an inevitable altruism, discard the vain phantom of internationalism, and reassert the pride of race and the right of merit to rule. The Nordic race has been driven from many of its lands, but still grasps firmly the control of the world, and it is certainly not at a greater numerical disadvantage than often before in contrast to the teeming population of Eastern Asia. It has repeatedly been confronted with crisis where the accident of battle or the genius of a leader saved a well-nigh hopeless day. It has survived defeat. It has survived the greater danger of victory. And, if it takes warning in time, it may face the future with assurance. Fight it must, but let that fight be not a civil war against its own blood kindred, but against the dangerous foreign races, whether they advanced sword in hand, or in the more insidious guise of beggars at our gates, pleading for admittance to share our prosperity. If we continue to allow them to enter, they will in time drive us out of our own land by mere force of breeding. The great hope of the future here in America lies in the realization of the working class that competition of the Nordic with the alien is fatal. Whether the latter be the lowly immigrant from Southern or Eastern Europe, or whether he be the more obviously dangerous Oriental, against whose standards of living the white man cannot compete. In this country, we must look to such of our people, our farmers and artisans, as are still of American blood, to recognize and meet this danger. Our present condition is the result of following the leadership of idealists and philanthropic doctrinaires, aided and abetted by the perfectly understandable demand of our captains of industry for cheap labor. Today, the need for statesmanship is great, and greater still is the need for thorough knowledge of history. All over the world, the first has been lacking, and in the passions of the Great War, the lessons of the past have been forgotten, both here and in Europe. The establishment of a chain of Alpine states from the Baltic to the Adriatic as a sequel to the war, all of them organized at the expense of the Nordic ruling classes, may bring Europe back to the days when Charlemagne, marching from the Rhine to the Elbe, found the valley of that river inhabited by heathen winds. Beyond lay Asia, and his successors spent 1,000 years pushing eastward the frontiers of Europe. Now that Asia, in the guise of Bolshevism with Semitic leadership and Chinese executioners, is organizing an assault upon Western Europe, the new states, Slavic, Alpine in race with little Nordic blood, may prove to be not frontier guards of Western Europe, but vanguards of Asia in Central Europe. None of the earlier Alpine states have held firm against Asia, and it is more than doubtful whether Poland, Bohemia, Romania, Hungary, and Yugoslavia can face the danger successfully now that they have been deprived of the Nordic ruling classes through democratic institutions. Democratic ideas among an homogeneous population of Nordic blood, as in England or America, is one thing, but it is quite another for the white man to share his blood with or entrust his ideas to brown, yellow, black, or red men. This is suicide, pure and simple. And the first victim of this amazing folly will be the white man himself. Madison Grant, New York, March 1, 1920.
Chapter 1. The World of Color. The man who, on a quiet spring evening of the year 1914, opened his atlas to a political map of the world and pored over its many-tinted patterns, probably got one fundamental impression: the overwhelming preponderance of the white race in the ordering of the world's affairs. Judged by accepted canons of statescraft, the white man towered the indisputable master of the planet. Forth from Europe's teeming mother hive, the imperious sons of Japhet had swarmed for centuries to plant their laws, their customs, and their battle flags at the uttermost ends of the earth. Two whole continents, North America and Australia, had been made virtually as white in blood as the European motherland. Two other continents, South America and Africa, had been extensively colonized by white stocks, while even huge Asia had seen its empty northern march, Siberia, preempted for the white man's abode. Even where white populations had not locked themselves to the soil, few regions of the earth had escaped the white man's imperial sway, and vast areas inhabited by uncounted myriads of dusky folk obeyed the white man's will. Beside the enormous area of white settlement or control, the regions under non-white governance bulked small indeed. In Eastern Asia, China, Japan, and Siam. In Western Asia, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Persia. In Africa, Abyssinia, and Liberia. And in America, the minute state of Haiti. Such was the brief list of lands under non-white rule. In other words, of the 53 million square miles which, excluding the polar regions, constitute the land area of the globe, only 6 million square miles had non-white governments, and nearly two-thirds of this relatively modest remainder was represented by China and its dependencies. Since 1914, the world has been convulsed by the most terrible war in recorded history. This war was primarily a struggle between the white peoples, who have borne the brunt of the conflict and have suffered most of the losses. Nevertheless, one of the war's results has been a further whittling down of the areas standing outside white political control. Turkey is today practically an Anglo-French condominium. Persia is virtually a protectorate of the British Empire. While the United States has thrown over the endemic anarchy of Haiti the aegis of the Pax Americana, study of the political map might thus apparently lead one to conclude that white world predominance is immutable, since the war's ordeal has still further broadened the territorial basis of its authority. At this point, the reader is perhaps asking himself why this book was ever undertaken. The answer is, the dangerous delusion aerated by viewing world affairs solely from the angle of politics. The late war has taught many lessons as to the unstable and transitory character of even the most imposing political phenomena. While a better reading of history must bring home the truth that the basic factor in human affairs is not politics, but race. The reader has already encountered this fundamental truth on every page of the introduction. He will remember, for instance, how West Central Asia, which in the dawn of history was predominantly white man's country, is today racially brown man's land, in which white blood survives only as vestigial traces of vanishing significance. If this portion of Asia, the former seat of mighty white empires and possibly the very homeland of the white race itself, should have so entirely changed its ethnic character, what assurance can the most impressive political panorama give us that the present world order may not swiftly and utterly pass away? The force of this query is exemplified when we turn from the political to the racial map of the globe. What a transformation! Instead of a world politically 9/10 white, we see a world of which only 4/10 at the most can be considered predominantly white in blood, the rest of the world being inhabited mainly by the other primary races of mankind: yellows, browns, blacks, and reds. Speaking by continents, Europe, North America to the Rio Grande, the southern portion of South America, the Siberian part of Asia, and Australasia constitute the real white world, while the bulk of Asia, virtually the whole of Africa, and most of Central and South America form the world of color. The respective areas of those two racially contrasted worlds are 22 million square miles for the whites and 31 million square miles for the colored races. Furthermore, it must be remembered that fully 1/3 of the white area, notably Australasia and Siberia, is very thinly inhabited and is thus held by a very slender racial tenure, the only tenure which counts in the long run. The statistical disproportion between the white and colored worlds becomes still more marked when we turn from surveys of area to tables of population. The total number of human beings alive today is about 1,007,000,000. Of these, 550 million are white, while 1,150,000,000 are colored. The colored races thus outnumber the whites more than 2-1. Another fact of capital importance is that the great bulk of the white race is concentrated in the European continent. In 1914, the population of Europe was approximately 450 million. The late war has undoubtedly caused an absolute decrease of many millions of souls. Nevertheless, the basic fact remains that some 4/5 of the entire white race is concentrated on less than 1/5 of the white world's territorial area, Europe, while the remaining 1/5 of the race, some 110 million souls, scattered to the ends of the earth, must protect 4/5 of the white territorial heritage against the pressure of colored races, 11 times its numerical strength. As to the 1,150,000,000 of the colored world, they are divided, as already stated, into four primary categories: yellows, browns, blacks, and reds. The yellows are the most numerous of the colored races, numbering over 500 million. Their habitat is Eastern Asia. Nearly as numerous and much more widespread than the yellows are the browns, numbering some 450 million. The browns spread in a broad belt from the Pacific Ocean westward across southern Asia and northern Africa to the Atlantic Ocean. The blacks total about 150 million. Their center is Africa, south of the Sahara Desert. But besides the African continent, there are vestigial black traces across southern Asia to the Pacific and also strong black outposts in the Americas. Least numerous of the colored race stocks are the Reds, the Indians of the Western Hemisphere. Mustering a total of less than 40 million, the Reds are almost all located south of the Rio Grande in Latin America. Such is the ethnic makeup of that world of color, which, as already seen, outnumbers the white world 2-1. That is a formidable ratio, and its significance is heightened by the fact that this ratio seems destined to shift still further in favor of color. There can be no doubt that at present, the colored races are increasing very much faster than the white. Treating the primary race stocks as units, it would appear that whites tend to double every 80 years, yellows and browns in 60 years, blacks in 40 years. The whites are thus the slowest breeders, and they will undoubtedly become slower still, since section after section of the white race is revealing that lowered birth rate, which in France has reached the extreme of a stationary population. On the other hand, none of the colored races shows perceptible signs of declining birth rate, all tending to breed up to the limits of available subsistence. Such checks as now limit the increase of colored populations are wholly external, like famine, disease, and tribal warfare. But by a curious irony of fate, the white man has long been busy removing these checks to colored multiplication. The greater part of the colored world is today under white political control. Wherever the white man goes, he attempts to impose the bases of his ordered civilization. He puts down tribal war. He wages truceless combat against epidemic diseases, and he so improves communications that augmented and better distributed food supplies minimize the blight of famine. In response to these life-saving activities, the enormous death rate, which in the past has kept the colored races from excessive multiplication, is falling to proportions comparable with the death rate of white countries. But to lower the colored world's prodigious birth rate is quite another matter. The consequence is a portentous increase of population in nearly every portion of the colored world now under white political sway. In fact, even those colored countries which have maintained their independence, such as China and Japan, are adopting the white man's life-conserving methods and are experiencing the same accelerated increase of population. Now, what must be the inevitable result of all this? It can mean only one thing. A tremendous and steadily augmenting outward thrust of surplus colored men from overcrowded colored homelands. Remember that these homelands are already populated up to the available limits of subsistence. Of course, present limits can in many cases be pushed back by better living conditions, improved agriculture, and the rise of modern machine industry, such as is already underway in Japan. Nevertheless, in view of the tremendous population increases which must occur, these can be only palliatives. Where, then, should the congested colored world tend to pour its accumulating human surplus, inexorably condemned to emigrate or starve? The answer is, into those emptier regions of the earth under white political control. But many of these relatively empty lands have been definitely set aside by the white man as his own special heritage. The upshot is that the rising flood of color finds itself walled in by white dikes, debarring it from many a promised land, which it would fain deluge with its dusky waves. Thus, the colored world, long restive under white political domination, is being welded by the most fundamental of instincts, the instinct of self-preservation, into a common solidarity of feeling against the dominant white man. And in the fire of a common purpose, internecine differences tend, for the time at least, to be burned away. Before the supreme fact of white political world domination, antipathies within the colored world must inevitably recede into the background. The imperious urge of the colored world toward racial expansion was well visualized by that keen English student of world affairs, Dr. E. J. Dillon, when he wrote more than a decade ago, "The problem is one of life and death. A veritable Sphinx question to those most nearly concerned. For no race, however inferior it may be, will consent to famish slowly in order that other people may fatten and take their ease, especially if it has a good chance to make a fight for life." This white statement of the colored thesis is an accurate reflection of what colored men say themselves. For example, a Japanese scholar, Professor Ryutaro Nagai, writes, "The world was not made for the white races, but for the other races as well. In Australia, South Africa, Canada, and the United States, there are vast tracts of unoccupied territory awaiting settlement, and although the citizens of the ruling powers refuse to take up the land, no yellow people are permitted to enter. Thus, the white races seem ready to commit to the savage birds and beasts what they refuse to entrust to their brethren of the yellow race. Surely the arrogance and avarice of the nobility in apportioning to themselves the most and the best of the land in certain countries is as nothing compared with the attitude of the white races toward those of a different hue. The bitter resentment of white predominance and exclusiveness awakened in many colored breasts is typified by the following lines penned by a brown man, a British-educated Afghan, shortly before the European War. Inveighing against our, quote, racial prejudice, that cowardly, wretched caste mark of the European and the American the world over, end quote. He exultantly predicts a, quote, coming struggle between Asia, all Asia, against Europe and America. You are heaping up material for a jihad, a pan-Islam, a pan-Asia holy war, a gigantic day of reckoning, an invasion of a new Attila and Tamerlane, who will use rifles and bullets instead of lances and spears. You are deaf to the voice of reason and fairness, and so you must be taught with the whirring swish of the sword when it is read. End quote. Of course, in these statements, there is nothing either exceptional or novel. The colored races never welcomed white predominance, and were always restive under white control. Down to the close of the 19th century, however, they generally accepted white hegemony as a disagreeable but inevitable fact. For 400 years, the white man had added continent to continent in his imperial progress, equipped with resistless sea power and armed with a mechanical superiority that crushed down all local efforts at resistance. In time, therefore, the colored races accorded to white supremacy a fatalistic acquiescence, and, though never loved, the white man was usually respected and universally feared. During the closing decades of the 19th century, to be sure, premonitory signs of a change in attitude began to appear. The yellow and brown races, at least, stirred by the very impact of Western ideas, measured the white man with a more critical eye, and commenced to wonder whether his superiority was due to anything more than a fortuitous combination of circumstances, which might be altered by efforts of their own. Japan put this theory to the test by going sedulously to the white man's school. The upshot was the Russo-Japanese War of 1904, an event the momentous character of which is even now not fully appreciated. Of course, that war was merely the sign manual of a whole nexus of forces making for a revivified Asia, but it dramatized and clarified ideas which had been germinating, half unconsciously, in millions of colored minds, and both Asia and Africa thrilled with joy and hope. Above all, the legend of white invincibility lay a fallen idol in the dust. Nevertheless, though freed from imaginary terrors, the colored world accurately gauged the white man's practical strength and appreciated the magnitude of the task involved in overthrowing white supremacy. That supremacy was no longer acquiesced in as inevitable, and hopes of ultimate success were confidently entertained. But the process was usually conceived as a slow and difficult one. Fear of white power and respect for white civilization thus remained potent restraining factors. Then came the Great War. The colored world suddenly saw the white peoples which, in racial matters, had hitherto maintained something of a united front, locked in an internecine death grapple of unparalleled ferocity. It saw those same peoples put one another furiously to the ban as irreconcilable foes. It saw white race unity cleft by political and moral gulfs, which white men themselves continuously iterated would never be filled. As colored men realized the significance of it all, they looked into each other's eyes and there saw the light of undreamed of hopes. The white world was tearing itself to pieces. White solidarity was riven and shattered, and fear of white power and respect for white civilization together dropped away like garments outworn. Through the bazaars of Asia ran the sibilant whisper, "The East will see the West to bed." The chorus of mingled exultation, hate, and scorn sounded from every portion of the colored world. Chinese scholars, Japanese professors, Hindu pundits, Turkish journalists, and Afro-American editors one and all voiced drastic criticisms of white civilization and hailed the war as a well-merited nemesis on white arrogance and greed. This is how the Constantinople Tanine, the most serious Turkish newspaper, characterized the European powers. Quote, "They would not look at the evils in their own countries or elsewhere, but interfered at the slightest incident in our borders. Every day, they would gnaw at some part of our rights and our sovereignty. They would perform vivisection on our quivering flesh and cut off great pieces of it. And we, with a forcibly controlled spirit of rebellion in our hearts, and with clenched but powerless fists, silent and depressed, would murmur as the fire burned within, 'Oh, that they might fall out with one another! Oh, that they might eat one another up!' And lo, today they are eating each other up, just as the Turk wished that they would." End quote. The Afro-American author W.E. Burghardt Du Bois wrote of the colored world, quote, "These nations and races, composing as they do a vast majority of humanity, are going to endure this treatment just as long as they must, and not a moment longer. Then they are going to fight, and the war of the color line will outdo in savage inhumanity any war this world has yet seen. For colored folk have much more to remember, and they will not forget." End quote. Quote, "What does the European war mean to us Orientals?" End quote, queried the Japanese writer Yone Noguchi. Quote, "It means the saddest downfall of the so-called Western civilization. Our belief that it was builded upon a higher and sounder footing than ours was at once knocked down and killed. We are sorry that we somehow overestimated its happy possibility and were deceived and cheated by its superficial glory. My recent Western journey confirmed me that the so-called dynamic Western civilization was all against the Asiatic belief. And when one does not respect the others, there will be only one thing to come, that is, fight in action or silence." End quote. Such was the colored world's reaction to the white death grapple. And as the long struggle dragged on, both Asia and Africa stirred to their very depths. To be sure, no great explosions occurred during the war years, albeit lifting the veils of censorship reveal how narrowly such explosions were averted. Nevertheless, Asia and Africa are today in acute ferment, and we must not forget that this ferment is not primarily due to the war. The war merely accelerated a movement already existent long before 1914. Even if the Great War had been averted, the 20th century must have been a time of widespread racial readjustments in which the white man's present position of political world domination would have been sensibly modified, especially in Asia. However, had the white race and white civilization been spared the terrific material and moral losses involved in the Great War and its still unliquidated aftermath, the process of racial readjustment would have been far more gradual and would have been fraught with far fewer cataclysmic possibilities. Had white strength remained intact, it would have acted as a powerful shock absorber, taking up and distributing the various colored impacts. As a result, the coming modification of the world's racial equilibrium, though inevitable, would have been so graduated that it would have seemed more an evolution than a revolution. Such violent breaches as did occur might have been localized, and anything like a general race cataclysm would probably have been impossible. But it was not to be. The heart of the white world was divided against itself, and on the fateful 1st of August, 1914, the white race, forgetting ties of blood and culture, heedless of the growing pressure of the colored world without, locked in a battle to the death. An ominous cycle opened whose end no man can foresee. Armageddon engendered Versailles. Earth's worst war closed with an unconstructive peace which left old sores unhealed and even dealt fresh wounds. The white world today lies debilitated and uncured. The colored world views conditions which are a standing incitement to rash dreams and violent action. Such is the present status of the world's race problem, expressed in general terms. The analysis of the specific elements in that complex problem will form the subject of the succeeding chapters.
Context of white supremacy. That is the first audio segment. We will pick up. We will be on Chapter 2, Yellow Man's Land, Chapter 2. At any rate, folks who would like to dial in, share a thought or two, feel free. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The only thing I'll say for this one, same, I generally do not do a whole lot of, you know, come on, you have to participate in the book club, which I probably won't do here either. However, I will say that you did hear Dr. Welsing at the beginning of the program. One of the last times that I spoke with her before her transition, she mentioned this book again. We talked because she asked me if I had read this book, and I have not, but I have read other works of Lothrop Stoddard. I read his book on the Haitian Revolution, and I was talking to Dr. Welsing about that and some of the major kind of takeaway points I remember from that book, and she was talking about this book and why she thought it was so important. That black people read this text, and this was like a year before the election. I don't even think the primaries had started yet, but just kind of keep that in mind that Dr. Welsing thought this was really important, so I think it would be grand. I think she would appreciate if we just pay attention to see if we think it's relevant. Do we see the value in this book and how this could help us understand White Supremacy 2016? And things that would help us help us solve this problem. Right on. If you do not want to call in with your phone, you can use the free vote line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinytiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tinytiny.cc/1race. When you put in that address, look on the left of the page. You will see the link for the free vote line. Click that. When you do so, it will open a small window on your screen. The first line, it is a drop down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. The final line, it will ask for a name. You can press random keys. You can use your real name. You can put in a nickname, whatever you are comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the program. You should be able to hear us live. It is the same procedure if you would like to join the conversation. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. When you do so, I will see your hand on the switchboard, and we will get you on the line. That's it. All the people who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard? Oh, greetings to all the callers. I'll be brief. wow. At first, it was I called in a little late, but then I actually found the text online. I appreciate that you said that last night, Gus. So I was actually going through the text last night, and the first thing that I noticed particularly was how many references that the author that in the beginning, Madison Grant's references to the Nordic or white people basically being the center of civilization, almost as if nothing else could survive without them. That's basically what we see today. in the system of white supremacy. And the other thing that I just, that immediately just stood out was how much research that this guy had to do in writing this book. And I immediately go back to what Mr. Fuller says, is that, you know, they know a lot about a lot, and they are always studying and studying and studying, and that, you know, just in this part of the world, but for centuries, their dedication to white supremacy is, they are not taking a day off. And it also, you know, just made me very, very aware of how much work that I myself have to do as an individual. I also wonder why this wouldn't be required reading for any black family. I know that I'm going to try to print it out online and go over it with my children, but I wish that my dad had an understanding or was a little bit less confused when I was younger, because I think a book like this is really, if you really put it into context, everything that you see today, it really just puts everything into context. I know my father had me read the autobiography of Malcolm X when I was 14, 13 years old. That was the first book he gave me. But a book like this, being honest and truthful about what whites are looking to do and their dedication to it and how long they've been dedicated to doing this, is extremely important. And Dr. Welsing, I can definitely understand why she suggested to read this book, because I was listening to her this afternoon, your conversation you had with her about Christopher Dorner, and she continued always to reference that chess game and how you have to read to understand the system. And if you have more knowledge, you'll be able to change your behavior effectively. So fascinating, but nothing surprised me. Violence, dedication to hurting and mistreating anybody in the known universe, as Mr. Fuller says. So that's all I got. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate that. Before the next caller speaks, I did want to make a correction. I said 1990 in the introduction for the program, and this book was published in 1920, not 1990. 1920, this book was originally published. Just correct myself. Other folks who were going to share?
Yes, sir. Greetings, everyone. Good text to study. It's I would assume that it was really designed for white people to get a perspective, to get an accurate perspective of what was going on at that time. The writer seems to be very scientific in his approach to what he is writing about. I can see from a historical standpoint, although I don't think he mentioned the Berlin Conference, but the Berlin Conference spilled over into from negotiating white supremacy to the actual physical aspect of white people falling out with one another on the issue of how to divide up the world. Now, he was talking about that. And we have to understand during that particular time is when steel was being developed and produced, and a lot of that was going to be coming from areas where non-white people are and still is, and in turn the writer expressed the fact about the vast majority of the people on the earth considered to be non-white. He did use the term white supremacy a whole lot, which tells you that was and still is the objective. At that time, they were in the expansion period still. They were still in the expansion period actually right near the end of it, I would say. Or kind of like midway through the end of it, as far as expansion is concerned. And there were, you know, new frontiers, quote unquote, to conquer and dominate and utilize the people and the resources. And in turn, I noticed he was speaking a lot about the non-white people who called Japanese, because at that time they were able to duplicate or copy, so to speak, some of the things that their white adversaries were doing, such as getting steel to use it for more into weaponry, also into shipping, locomotives, so on and so forth. And he did mention about the Japanese-Russia war that took place. And in turn, white people knew that they had to eventually physically put Japan asunder later on. That I know it's not in the book since the book was written in 1920. But they knew it at that time that they were going to physically have a physical confrontation directly with the people who, the non-white people who are called Japanese. What else? I mentioned about steel. Very little direct talk about non-white, quote unquote, black people, which is understandable at that particular point in time. Interesting mention about W.E.B. Du Bois did make some copy on some of his quotes, and that's basically my thoughts as far as he was more or less seemed to be preparing white people through his scientific research and study about the course of racism, white supremacy, and where it's going to go. Thank you.
Right on. Before we get our other speakers, retired firefighter just reminded me W.E.B. Du Bois and Lothrop Stoddard had a big debate early in the 20th century, obviously dealing with racism. Worth investigating if you want to Google Lothrop Stoddard, W.E.B. Du Bois debate and see what comes up. Other folks,
that would be interesting.
Very, very great study. other folks that we haven't heard from have commentary?
Can I be heard? Oh, go ahead, bro.
All right. Thank you. Greetings to you, Gus, and to Firefighter in Florida and the other callers and the listeners. Yeah, this book is actually phenomenal. I see that there's quite a bit of propaganda, like the first caller was saying. Can I be heard okay?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah, there's quite a bit of propaganda just as far as whitening quite a bit of history. There was on page, this is our 12 in Roman numerals, it says, one of the chief results of forcing the Nordic race back to the seacoast was the creation of maritime power and its development to a degree never before known, even in the days of the Phoenicians and Carthaginians. And that is so laughable simply because the Phoenicians were one of the greatest maritime powers in history. The Atlantic Ocean was actually called originally the Ethiopian Ocean simply because black people were going between Africa and the Americas for so many thousands of years that we were constantly seen on that ocean. So originally that's what it was called before white people changed the name to the Atlantic. So I just find that very interesting. White people weren't doing much, anything anywhere near as important as far as maritime in comparison to the Phoenicians, Carthaginians, and absolutely Africans. You had Nile Valley Africans here thousands of years before Christ trading in cocaine and tobacco. So I just found that very hilarious. Also, he wrote shortly below that on the same page, nevertheless, long before the opening of the Christian era, the Alpines of Western Europe were thoroughly Nordicized, and the centuries that followed, the old Nordic element in Spain, Italy, and France has again and again strongly reinforced so that these lands are now an integral part of the white world. And I find that laughable simply because Spanish people and Italians specifically, because they were dominated by black people and they had such a heavy strain of black blood, due to that, and then specifically in Italy, prior to that, the original people in Italy and in that area were black people. So none of those people were really considered white. Even in the Americas, in early American history, Italians used to get lynched as well as black people because they were considered niggers as well. So they weren't even given honorary white status until a lot later in history. So I found that to be very telling as well. excuse me, on the following page, she wrote, Rome, after she emerged triumphant from her struggle with the Carthaginians of Mediterranean race, plunged into a series of civil wars which ended in the complete elimination of the native Nordic element in Rome. And then beneath that, he wrote, the backbone of Western civilization is racially Nordic, the Alpines and Mediterraneans being effectively precisely to the extent in which they have been Nordicized and vitalized. If this great race with its capacity for leadership and fighting should ultimately pass, with it would pass which we call civilization. And it reminds me of a conversation I just had 2 days ago with a coworker, in which I said to him, this that we're living in right now, this system of white supremacy where we're dying, you know, wholesale on camera and all this kind of stuff that they're doing to our people, is what they call civilization. So imagine what an uncivilized life amongst these white people would really be like if what we're living in is what they're calling civilization. And then lastly, before I go, there was one last section on page 3, actually, in the book, where it says the brown spread in a broad belt from the Pacific Ocean westward across southern Asia and northern Africa to the Atlantic Ocean. The blacks total about 150 million. Their center is Africa, south of the Sahara Desert, but besides the African continent, there are vestigial black races across southern Asia to the Pacific and also strong outposts in the Americas. Least numerous of the colored race stocks are the Reds, the Indians of the Western Hemisphere, mustering a total of less than 40 million. The Reds are almost all located south of the Rio Grande in Latin America. I find that to be very telling, simply because he is actually stating that there was a heavy stock of African people on the African continent, the American continent, which really lends credence to the fact that there were only about 60,000 people that came from the continent to the United States, and that the original people they encountered in North America were black people who are and always were the indigenous of the United States. Thank you, and with that, I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everybody. I remember hearing about this book a couple of years ago. I was watching the Dr. Jenner Henry Clark lecture, and one of the people who were presenting had recommended this book because I think somebody in the audience was talking about this was a lecture that was taped in the early 90s. And during that time, Yugoslavia was going through a war. And one of the speakers there had recommended this book. So I found it online for free. And I thought it was very, very interesting. I mean, it's almost like the codification manual for white supremacy, and it's real interesting, real telling as well. The book basically was a necessity during that time because of the fact that, you know, you had World War One, which, you know, Mr. Stoddard even described as, you know, the Great War amongst white people, if you ask me. And then basically you also had in the 1920s the rise of the Garvey movement. So it was like the alarm started to set off with white people, you know, even though they were still, you know, white supremacy was still intact, you know, they saw these movements and shifts coming, and basically Mr. Stoddard, you know, saw this and decided to write this book. It's also interesting, you know, the barbaric nature of white people. I mean, it's very barbaric. This is a people that already dominated the world, and they had nobody else to fight except themselves. So you have the great cataclysmic of World War One, which is also interesting when you talk about World War One, because World War Two is always romanticized, but no one, you know, I never hear anybody talk about World War One. As far as, you know, there might be some movies on World War One, and, you know, you might find some books, but there's like a plethora of information on World War Two, but never World War One is like really talked about. So I found that very interesting. It also tells me about how white people view Russians, because, you know, obviously, in reading just this first section, you know, they talk about how Russians were intermingled with, you know, the Mongoloids, and how, you know, Russians aren't pure, you know, pure white people, according to what, you know, they're saying in this book. So it's interesting how, you know, we view Russians for their political, for being a political communist, but you know, Mr. Stoddard, you know, actually says that it's not about politics, it's about race. So I often wonder why America's hatred for Russia and also with the Nordic countries in Europe, you know, like Great Britain, who also, you know, is very opposed to Russia. Is it about their politics or is it that they're not pure, you know, pure blood Nordic? So and also, too, I was saying earlier, this basically tells you about why Yugoslavia has gone through all these wars, with white people fighting themselves just because they're not, you know, pure Nordic stock. So I guess that's it for me, and I'll mute my line.
The folks that we...
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi there, this is Mel. I had about 3 points. I wanted to note that the entire intro and arguably the first chapter, it seems like the author emphasizes... Well, actually, really the entire intro, the author emphasizes how he thinks that everyone non-white seems to be as innately imperial or like about innate imperialism or colonialism as white people are. And I find that to be very interesting. Like he thinks that the whole world is watching when I guess during, I'm not very familiar with wars, but when there seems to be a war between two white powers, he thinks that all the non-white people of the world are looking, Japanese, quote unquote, Turkish, black, the select quotation from Du Bois saying that they're all watching and sort of, I guess, judging that, and it's like they're watching with hunger and with this eagerness to see white people implode upon themselves. And so I find it interesting how it seems to be an innate quality in white supremacist culture, and when they look at non-white threats, they view them with that same, that same eye. Another point I had was that when the author, this book is all about selective quotations, in my opinion. If he wants to justify that Japanese people feel a certain way, he'll use a Japanese author. If he wants to say that, you know, African people or black people think a certain way, he'll use a black author. He used Du Bois and the Japanese author, but I guess I just want to keep that in mind for the first chapter. And then my last point was that I actually took an Asian studies class last semester, and shamefully, it was taught by a white person, suspected white supremacist, and I learned a lot about how this is really a comment for the first chapter, but I learned a lot about how the white supremacists emphasize wars between non-white people and other non-white people. Well, basically, they emphasize the Chinese Revolution and how it was a series of Chinese atrocities committed upon other Chinese people. But the Russo-Japanese War was not at all talked about in my class. And this is, mind you, an Asian studies class. So I learned nothing about the war between the Russians and the Japanese, but I learned all about the war between Chinese and other Chinese people. That was just a class I had this semester. Those were all of my comments for now. I'm just listening in for Aaron, really. Thanks.
Thank you kindly, Mel. That is our narrator for Asada Shakur. Folks with us last year when we read that, and our editor for the audio recording this week. Great job getting the audio collated for us. Any other folks that we haven't heard from have commentary that they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Someone else mentioned it, but I think it just bears mentioning again that they're very clear that nothing else matters other than race. Everything is about race. And I feel like it's important to just keep that in mind because everyone's trying, not everyone, but there's a really big push to put in our face that it's not race and it's a host of other things. When the beginning and end of the conversation, it's race. And it's clearly stated in the beginning and throughout the entire book. Another thing that stood out to me was just how much effort went into this side. Because a lot of people will think that racists are very ignorant and dumb, but clearly not the case with this individual here and the verboseness of the piece, of the book, or even the introduction in the first couple of chapters. And then I was, you know, while it was being read, I was like, did they really just calculate the mileage of who owns what about the earth? I just found that, I don't know, I was just, my mind was boggled on that one. I couldn't believe it. Like, did they really just calculate who owns how much of the earth at what time? And it made me think of Pinky and the Brain and how there's a lot of joking about, you know, world domination, but that's clearly it. And then it also made me think about, you know, Dr. Welsing is always talking about how reading is more fundamental. And clearly, how can I say, but it was perhaps maybe this book that really, really fueled some of her research and her theories, because they clearly say, there's only so many of us, white people, and there's a whole lot of everybody else. And we got to make sure we keep them at bay and control them so that we can make sure that we stay here, which is genetic annihilation. Because then they also say whites are slower breeders. And I was thinking, because I remember hearing the thing about France, but that was put in my face as if that was new. So to hear that 1920s France was already at like a zero population growth, which leads me to believe that they're probably negative population growth now at this point. And to already know that whites are slower breeders. And so after saying that, that made everything else propaganda. If you're slower, like, I don't understand how you can be superior. If you can't, I don't want to say breed, but have babies easily, naturally, and be bountiful in babies. That just doesn't make any sense to me. Because it's also not just getting pregnant, it's also being able to have the baby and also raise the baby, like keep the baby and make a better baby. I don't know if I'm being articulate with that, but it's not just about being able to get pregnant. So many of them died in childbirth, like they're all humpbacks. Anyway, then there's a part where he says neglect altruism, and I was like, wow, you know, like so many times we're talking about whether or not they have soul or they have heart or they have feelings at all. Even if they did, some of their prominent leaders are pretty much saying neglect it, bump that, screw that. No, there's no room for, you know, compassion or any sort of humanity towards anybody else, just us whites. And then around that same area where that was stated, he said merit-based, which made me think of that movie with, goodness, I'm forgetting his name, but they have the Necromongers, Chronicles of Riddick, there we go. And they have the Necromongers, and it's pretty much you keep what you kill, which has been iterated in other films. But in this one, because that was pretty much merit-based, like if you were able to kill or conquer, then you could keep it. And I just, you know, I completely understand why Dr. Welsing was saying that this is something that this book is something that we should read, because they're laying it out for us. And I won't say clearly, because it really is verbose, and I will speak for myself. I was like, get to the point. It was so many words, but it's there. They are pretty much saying how they feel. And it's really unfortunate, because I'm confident that they're having these conversations with their children. And we're not, as far as I know, having wide scale conversations with our children to let them know, number one, what we know about them, but also informing our children and young people about what they're saying about us. So many young people are really going out and interacting with these white people thinking that they can be won over, or thinking that this is just, you know, because they're not exposed. And it's really not. This is very deliberate, very intentional. And with that, I'll mute myself. Thank you. Oh, and kudos to the reader. Very well done, because it is extremely verbose. So kudos.
And our editor, Mel. Anyone else that we have not heard from have commentary they wanted to get in? We got everybody. Didn't miss anybody. All righty. I will double check as we continue rolling along to make sure we didn't miss anyone. We still have a few minutes before we get to the second audio segment. Some of the things that stood out, I guess, number one, do folks know who Madison Grant is? Does that name mean anything to anybody? Madison Grant?
That's me.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
You know, I'm looking that person up now on Google, but know that I do not know this person.
Oh, okay.
I know he had a lot to do with the eugenics movement in the early 1900s. I do remember hearing that name pretty frequently.
Okay. He wrote the first section, right? He wrote the introduction of what we read today, which was sizable. That was about half of what we heard was Madison Grant, not Lothrop Stoddard. And I would say they're kind of on par, Madison Grant, Lothrop Stoddard. I don't know what a, like, 2016 equivalent would be to have two, like, towering academics who had so much influence and who were so well known. And he has a very popular book that's kind of along the same theme. Passing of the Great Race is the name of the book that Madison Grant wrote about the same time period. But they were both prominent eugenicists, both white men, both involved in getting the Planned Parenthood movement off and rolling. It's pretty remarkable. Like, I don't know if there's a way I could, like, correlate it to 21st century. Maybe if trying to think of, like, towering academics of today. Maybe if, like, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a book and Michelle Alexander wrote the foreword. But even that is underselling it, because they're victims of racism. Like, these are prominent white men at a time where you could openly kill black people, and they're writing about white supremacy on a world stage. So even something like that is underselling. This was a major seller, and it was not looked at the way that people would look at, like, a Bill O'Reilly or something, where they would look, or a Donald Trump. I think Dr. Welsing said that in the intro, that this is a lot more sophisticated than Donald Trump. So people at this in the 1920s, they wouldn't have looked at this like, oh my gosh, you know, that right-wing crackpot Lothrop Stoddard. That would not have been the way people thought about it at all. It would be like, oh wow, that Stoddard guy, he really knows what he's talking about. This is a big problem. We gotta, you know, I mean, that's really, like, that's the way that you need to think about in terms of how this would have been processed at that time, publicly, not behind closed doors. Some of the things that stood out and to look for the debate, Dubois Lothrop Stoddard, if you can find the debate to check that out, that would be great as well. Some of the notes that I took during the chapter, I think it should go without saying that for a book like this, and with everything that he's talking about with history, whites lie a lot. So this would definitely be a book that certainly any question, any suspicion about any of the claims that he's making should be interrogated. Just be thinking, a race soldier wrote this book, so I'm not going to take anything. He does not get the benefit of the doubt for anything. And I would hope that nobody purchased this book. Again, it's old enough, the copyrights have fallen away, so you can download a copy of this book for free. An electronic copy shouldn't have to shell out any coins to get a copy of the book. Some of the things that stood out that I highlighted from this portion, right in the beginning, and this would be, I guess, Madison Grant, some of the things that he wrote. He says the Eurasiatic continent has been, perhaps since the origin of life itself, the most active center of evolution and radiation of higher forms. Just the grandiosity and the narcissism of all this, that, you know, we are supreme, and then we have to write and give you all of the, you know, evidence of our domination. And, you know, just how far advanced we are above all of you, you know, no-count primitive dark people. Let's see, continuing where he says, and yeah, he's just kind of running it down. A lot of the first portion just seems, I think was stated before, the propaganda of just convincing you of just how cool it is to be a member of the white race. All the evidence points to the origins of the primates in Eurasia, and we have every reason to believe that this continent was also the scene of the early evolution of man from his anthropod ancestors. Not only do I think that is categorically false, as I stated before, the propaganda and the narcissism that is kind of underlying all of this, I think Dr. Welsing has talked about that a lot. This myth of supremacy, where you have to tell all of these lies to convince others of your supremacy. I thought the portion where he says on the Northwest, groped around the Baltic and North Seas lies the Greek Nordic race. It is characterized by a fair white skin, wavy hair with a range of color from dark brown to flaxen, light eyes, tall stature, and long skulls. I thought it was quite peculiar to say characterized by a fair white skin. Particularly in that context, why would you need fair and white? If fair is not supposed to mean white in this sentence, the other definitions for fair, when it's in accordance with rules or standards, legitimate, certainly it could also mean beautiful. But it just, in my view, that again cements why I say we should avoid using the word fair because of the connotations, denotations of the word. And this is not something where people said the word fair and meant beautiful, you know, 500 years ago, but they don't do that anymore. That's not the case. I still hear people like right now using the word fair to mean all of those different concepts, beauty, intelligence, justice, whiteness, all of those concepts. So I really, 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 in my view, avoid using the term fair. Next, I thought it was interesting. They kind of went through all of this effort to convince us of the superior white Nordic race, where he continues to say, during the second millennium before our era, successive waves of Nordics began to cross the Afghan passes into India until finally they imposed their primitive Aryan language on Hindustan and the countries lying to the east. Just referring to these Aryans, who would be presumably individuals classified as white, as primitive. Thought that was interesting, maybe even a slip where some truth got in. I appreciated the honesty. I think Hitler in Mein Kampf has quite a few passages that just make it plain, where it's no pussyfooting. We're not trying to convince you that it's about class or, you know, all this other foolishness, where he just makes it plain. The conflict between the East and the West, Europe and Asia, has thus lasted for centuries. And they just, you know, put this in very clear color terms in terms of what this is all about. How much melanin do people have? I thought it was interesting as well when he talks about the conflict between white people, World War One, when he says another class of wars, however, has been absolutely deadly to the Nordic race. There must have been countless early struggles when one Nordic tribe attacked and exterminated its rivals, such as the Trojan War, fought between the Achaeans and Phrygians, between both Nordics, while the later Peloponnesian War was purely civil strife between Greeks and resulted in the racial collapse of Hellas. Just continually talking about whites fighting other whites. I know we touched on that in Urugu, Dr. Marimba Ani, that the incomplete essence, spirit of Urugu, individuals classified as white, leads them to this savage, violent behavior. And if they didn't have non-white people around to organize and terrorize, to kind of focus their violent behaviors, that they would just be in conflict with one another. I think one of the callers already made that point during the broadcast. A few other quick tidbits, and then if folks have other comments they want to get in. I thought this, the paragraph where he says, this is all still Madison Grant too. Democratic ideals among an homogenous population of Nordic blood, as in England or America, is one thing, but it is quite another for the white man to share his blood with or entrust his ideals to brown, yellow, black, or red men. I thought this was a fascinating paragraph from Grant because, first, it reminded me of many of the conversations that we've had where we talk about, as the number of non-white people in a specific region goes up, you start to see laws change and become much more draconian. That's why you have drug laws and what have you here. That's why they have a great healthcare program in Canada, because you have a much smaller population of black people. It reminded me of that quite a bit to begin with. And then the portion where he says, where you have a homogenous population of Nordic blood, as in England or America. This is 1920 America. I don't exactly know. I mean, you have a substantial population of Negroes in this part of the world at that time. I don't exactly think this would qualify as a homogenous population. Let's see, the portion, in this kind of warning, it reminded me, even that section that I just read, it reminded me a lot of the talk that you hear around Brexit about fears of multiculturalism that you'll hear different people talking about across Europe, and even some whites here reminded me a lot of that as well. I think the female caller that was talking about how mind-boggling it was that they had computed down to like the square mile the amount of territory that was directly dominated by whites and the amount of territory that was dominated allegedly by non-white people. Just to me, it reminded me of Mr. Fuller when he says a racist will study a grain of sand. Like, to be thinking in that much detail about dominating everyone, dominating the known universe. I mean, that is amazing, to just be sitting around and thinking in that much detail about who controls what on the planet and what do the stakes look like as the population goes up. Same thing, I think many of the comments that were made about the France and their population rate, their birth rate, it seems like I hear those exact same types of things being said today. And again, that could be lies. That could just be population to motivate or manipulate whites into doing certain things that would be helpful to racism. But I hear those exact same types of statistics quoted today. Again, just appreciated the clarity where he says, this is now Lothrop Stoddard that I'm quoting, where he says, while a better reading of history must bring home the truth that the basic factor in human affairs is not politics, but race, rarely hear whites be that honest and direct about what things are. I'm pretty much done, I think. Oh, yeah, talk about folly. We talked about lies. I thought this section was rich, where he says, the greater part of the colored world is today under white political control. Wherever the white man goes, he attempts to impose the basis of his ordered civilization. He puts down tribal war, he wages traceless combat against epidemic disease, and he so improves communications that augmented and better distributed food supplies minimize the blight of famine. Wow, he just makes whites sound like the most swell folks you could ever have around. They will solve all of your problems and make everything like infinitely better. If we just had a few more of these whites that he is referencing, all our problems would be taken care of and there would be no need for this radio program. That's why I said all suspicion is warranted in reading any of the claims that he is throwing out as we move through this text. I think I will stop there. Let me nab some of the folks who dialed in that we have not heard from. The caller at 4757. 4757, did you have commentary?
Hey, Gus, can I be there?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus, this is Ramon from 719. I thought it interesting, too, about the mention of the Nordic. I've been studying the Druids, and what I found out about the Druid is that they were the forefathers of this whole Nordic thing that they talk about. And I'm starting to find it curious in this book. I started reading some of the text myself, and I'm almost wondering if he's co-opting the history of the Druids as the Nordic. So that's what stands out to me when as you talk about that. I really don't quite know how to explain it in its depth, but my question is, could it be he's talking truly about the Druid? Because what I learned about the Druids as they split up later as Celtic and Scottish and things like that is that it was acknowledged that they were broken up into two types, which was the P-Celt and the Q-Celt. And I'll mute my line.
I'm not knowledgeable enough about that to know whether he's fabricating or practicing some sort of deception where he's taking from things that these people did and attributing it to Nordics, what have you. I'm not sure if that's the case, but like I said, suspicion is certainly warranted. If you've done your studies and that's what you think is happening, pursue that line of thinking. But certainly I would just encourage everyone, you have any suspicions about any of the claims that are being being made, do your research and certainly do not do not feel inhibited or think that there's something incorrect about having suspicions that, you know, he could be making some of this up or lying or trying to pull one over on you as a reader. Go ahead and definitely follow through on those suspicions. Do your own research. Other folks have commentary? Anybody that we missed have commentary?
Hey, Gus?
Yes, sir.
You know what? I just thought about something because you were talking about a scholar that might, you know, be close to what Mr. Stoddard is. Have you ever heard of Mary Lefkowitz?
I don't believe so.
She wrote a book a couple years ago called Knock Out of Africa and basically tried to argue about, I guess what they called, what she called Afrocentricity and all the history that, you know, people like Dr. Clark and Dr. Bien had brought to the community. So that's probably the closest thing I can think of as a contemporary for Lafayette Stoddard is Mary Lefkowitz.
And even with that, that's why I said I was having difficulty. Again, it would not be someone, she doesn't sound like someone who people think of as like an academic luminary, like someone who's respected and people want to hear from. This sounds like someone who people might think, who might, the descriptor might be controversial. Like, I don't think this is someone who's thought of as like a leading researcher in their field on matters of race or social sciences or anything like that. That's what Lothrop Stoddard was, and Madison Grant, by the way. At the time that this book was published, it was not, you know, that controversial crackpot up in the air. That's not what it was at all by any stretch of the imagination.
I mean, it was close, but the Wall Street Journal did like her book, so It is popular amongst white people.
The caller at 1282, did you have a commentary you wanted to share?
Yes, hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes. Hi. This is my first time calling in. I always catch the show on YouTube, but it's always been a problem for me to try to catch the live show. So I finally got through. I came on late. I didn't hear what the show was about, but I guess I'll just comment based on what I've heard you speak about.
Hang on. This is the book study, and I try to catch that because we do have people who call in who either have not listened to the book at all, or they call in and they want to talk about things that have nothing to do with the book. So this is our book study session. I do try to encourage people to stay on topic with what we are talking about. So. Did you not hear?
No, it was just a comment you made about the guy speaking about evolution, and I was going to make a comment about that. But, you know, I guess I'll just go back and listen in and just call in another time.
Yeah, I know you were saying you had some difficulties chiming in and get you on the first time, but I just because people get way off topic on the book club, like we start off talking about this book and end up talking about, you know, a movie that came out last week and things that just have absolutely nothing to do with the book. That's the only reason. If you want to get your
absolutely
comment.
Absolutely understandable.
For sure. If you want to get your comment in about evolution before we get to the second audio, we'll make time for that as well. Just let me double check to make sure anybody had any book related comments they wanted to get in before we move forward, and I'll get your comment in as well, sir. Thank you for being patient. Anybody else have book related commentary, observations they wanted to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I was going to say, I found it interesting that one of the previous callers brought up Mary Lefkowitz because she had a great debate with John Henry Clark. People can check out on YouTube. That was phenomenal. But what I found her to be for the time frame, which was probably like the late 80s, early 90s, she was probably the person trying to resurrect some of the ideas that Lothrop Stoddard had as far as trying to make white people people unto themselves who did all of these wonderful things without any influence from African people at all. And she, to me, was kind of like the torchbearer for the resurrection of academic white supremacy. She wasn't what Lothrop Stoddard was as far as how important and how big of a personality he was for the time that he was alive. But I think that she was one of the main proponents of ideals similar to his. And at that time, she was trying to propagate that sort of mentality. And after that debate, everything was, her whole her whole premise was shut down after the debate with Dr. John Henry Clark. But yeah, I just found it interesting too that he used the term Hindustan, because that's a made up term. The term Hindu itself, this is Lathrop Stoddard. The term Hindu came from the fact that white people could not pronounce the original name of India, which was actually Sindh. It was S-I-N-D, and they couldn't pronounce that S sound, so they turned it into Hind, and eventually we started calling them Hindu people because of white people's inability to actually properly pronounce names, which is something that we've talked about numerous times on the program. So yeah, there's quite a bit to listen for in regards to, like you were saying, lies and propaganda, because it was quite a bit of propaganda, and he was commandeering quite a bit of white ethnic groups' history. And I just found it interesting that he would say that the Slavic people were Nordic people, but yet he was also equating Western Bloc Europeans with being Nordic people, when actually the Western Bloc Europeans enslaved the Eastern Bloc Europeans, which is the Slavic people, and that's where we get the term slave from. So mm-hmm. to me, there's a lot of mixture of history there in the book. So like you were saying, there's quite a bit to look out for in regards to what he's propagating. Thank you.
We have about 5 minutes left. Folks have any other comments they wanted to get in? You can see the debate between Mary Lefkowitz and Dr. John Henry Clark online. They have it on YouTube, but everything is on YouTube. Any other comments folks wanted to get in? Everybody satisfied? Nothing else stood out? I thought it was a exquisite metaphor at the close of the first chapter, where he writes, "The upshot is that the rising flood of color finds itself walled in by white dikes, debarring it from many a promised land which it would fain deluge with its dusky waves." Quite a metaphor, and continuing it with this sense of whites being drowned. And I even thought his proportions were a bit off. Like, I think he said that about 40%, was that the statistic that he threw out? About 40% of the world's population would be people classified as white, which I think is pretty pretty off, overinflated to say the least. But I think he said about 40%. Did anybody remember a different number, or was it about 40%?
I believe you were correct that he did say something in the range or around about 40%. And yeah, they're always inflating everything about themselves, because at that point, I'm thinking that there were probably less white people around then than there are now, actually. So I just think that a lot of the numbers that he was giving out regarding the white population was inflated, but yet he would come back around, and that, you know, that's the double speed. He would then come back around and speak about their low birth rates and the fact that they were not giving birth at the rate of non-white people. So, you know, he did a whole lot of, like you say, obfuscation of facts and reality.
For sure. I would enjoy reading this with the maps that he has the illustrations in the book, but it would be cool to just have like a globe as you're reading this, so that you can look at the different parts of the world as he's talking about, as he according to the map that he includes with the book, so you can see it, you know, what it looked like in 1920.
Oh yeah, Gus, you know what I also found interesting too is that in one section of the book, when he was talking about the different populations of non-white groups, he equated the entire continent of Africa and then separated Abyssinia, which was nothing but another name for Ethiopia. And Ethiopia at that time would have encompassed the area, that we would see today on a modern map, whereas in ancient times, Ethiopia encompassed the entire African continent, because it was a Greek term for black people, and basically they called the entire continent Ethiopia. So I just found that interesting, too, that he would, like, separate specifically Ethiopia and then also say Africa as if Africa was a country and not an entire continent. So there's a lot of play with words there that we have to really look out for.
Good point. I will assume folks are satisfied for the time being. The male caller who's going to share his point about evolution before we get to the second audio segment. Did you want to share, sir? Mm-hmm. the male caller? I thought you were going to share your view on evolution. Are you still with us, or did you hang up? We may have lost him. I will assume we lost him. We will go ahead and get to the second audio segment. If, sir, if you're still with us and you want to share your comment, you can do so after the second audio segment concludes. We should have ample time. So we're picking up. We are on chapter two. Chapter two of The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, Mr. Lothrop Stoddard. Again, thanks to our narrator. Hope folks are able to follow along. Drop me an email if you need a hard copy. As I said, you can just download this for free. It's readily available online. If you want to follow along, I know some of it can be difficult if you're just listening. Drop me an email if you need help. We will get started. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number two, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy.
Chapter 2, Yellow Man's Land. Yellow Man's Land is the Far East. Here the group of kindred stocks, usually termed Mongolian, have dwelt for unnumbered ages. Down to the most recent times, the Yellows lived virtually a life apart. Sundered from the rest of mankind by stupendous mountains, burning deserts, and the illimitable ocean, the Far East constituted a world in itself, living its own life and developing its own peculiar civilization. Only the wild nomads of its northern marches, Huns, Mongols, Tartars, and the like, succeeded in gaining direct contact with the brown and white worlds to the west. The ethnic focus of the Yellow World has always been China. Since the dawn of history, this immense human ganglion has been the center from which civilization has radiated throughout the Far East. About this Middle Kingdom, as it sapiently styled itself, the other Yellow folk were disposed. Japanese and Koreans to the east, Siamese, Annamites, and Cambodians to the south, and to the north, the nomad Mongols and Manchus. To all these peoples, China was the august preceptor, sometimes chastising their presumption, yet always instilling the principles of its ordered civilization. However diverse may have been the individual developments of the various Far Eastern peoples, they spring from a common Chinese foundation. Despite modern Japan's meteoric rise to political mastery of the Far East, it must not be forgotten that China remains not only the cultural, but also the territorial and racial center of the Yellow World. 4/5 of the Yellow race is concentrated in China, there being nearly 400 million Chinese as against 60 million Japanese, 16 million Koreans, 26 million Indo-Chinese, and perhaps 10 million people of non-Chinese stocks included within China's political frontiers. The age-long seclusion of the Yellow World, first decreed by nature, was subsequently maintained by the voluntary decision of the Yellow peoples themselves. The great expansive movement of the white race, which began 4 centuries ago, soon brought white men to the Far East by sea in the persons of the Portuguese navigators and by land with the Cossack adventurers ranging through the empty spaces of Siberia. Yet after a brief acquaintance with the white strangers, the Yellow World decided that it wanted none of them, and they were rigidly excluded. This exclusion policy was not a Chinese peculiarity. It was common to all the Yellow peoples, and was adopted spontaneously at about the same time. In China, Japan, Korea, and Indochina, the same reaction produced the same results. The Yellow World instinctively felt the white man to be a destructive, dissolving influence on its highly specialized line of evolution, which it wished to maintain unaltered. For 3 centuries, the Yellow World succeeded in maintaining its isolation. Then, in the middle of the last century, insistent white pressure broke down the barriers and forced the Yellow races into full contact with the outer world. At the moment, the opening of the Far East was hailed by white men with general approval. But of late years, many white observers have regretted this forcible dragging of reluctant races into the full stream of world affairs. As an Australian writer, J. Liddell Kelly, remarks, quote, "We have erred grievously by prematurely forcing ourselves upon Asiatic races. The instinct of the Asiatic in desiring isolation and separation from other forms of civilization was much more correct than our craze for imposing our forms of religion, morals, and industrialism upon them. It is not race hatred, nor even race antagonism, that is at the root of this attitude. It is an unerring intuition, which in years gone by has taught the Asiatic that his evolution in the scale of civilization could be best accomplished by his being allowed to develop on his own lines. pernicious European compulsion has led him to abandon that attitude. Let us not be ashamed to confess that he was right and we were wrong. End quote. However, rightly or wrongly, the deed was done, and the yellow races, forced into the world arena, proceeded to adapt themselves to their new political environment and to learn the correct methods of survival under the strenuous conditions which there prevailed. In place of their traditional, equilibrated, self-sufficient order, the yellow peoples now felt the ubiquitous impacts of the dynamic Western spirit, insistent upon rapid material progress and forceful, expansive evolution. Japan was the first yellow people to go methodically to the white man's school, and Japan's rapid acquirement of the white man's technology soon showed itself in dramatic demonstrations, like her military triumphs over China in 1894, and over Russia a decade later. Japan's easy victory over huge China astounded the whole world. That these highly intelligent children, as one of the early British ministers to Japan had characterized them, should have so rapidly acquired the technique of Western methods was almost unbelievable. Indeed, the full significance of the lesson was not immediately grasped, and the power of New Japan was still underestimated. A good example of Europe's underestimation of Japanese strength was the proposal a Dutch writer made in 1896 to curb possible Japanese aggression on the Dutch Indies by taking from Japan the island of Formosa, which Japan had acquired from China as one of the fruits of victory. Holland, asserted this writer, quote, must take possession of Formosa, end quote. The grotesqueness of this dictum as it appears to us in the light of subsequent history shows how the world has moved in 25 years. But even at that time, Japan's expansionist tendencies were well developed, and voices were warning against Japanese imperialism. In the very month when our Hollander was advocating a Dutch seizure of Formosa, an Australian wrote the following lines in a Melbourne newspaper concerning his recent travels in Japan. Quote, while in a car with several Japanese officers, they were conversing about Australia, saying that it was a fine, large country with great forests and excellent soil for the cultivation of rice and other products. The whites settled in Australia, so thought these officers, are like the dog in the manger. Someone will have to take a good part of Australia to develop it, for it is a pity to see so fine a country lying waste. If any ill feeling arose between the two countries, it would be a wise thing to send some battleships to Australia and annex part of it. End quote. Whatever may have been the world's misreading of the Chino-Japanese conflict, the same cannot be said of the Russo-Japanese War of 1904. The echoes of that yellow triumph over one of the great white powers reverberated to the ends of the earth, and started obscure trains of consequences even today not yet fully disclosed. The war's reactions in these remoter fields will be discussed in later chapters. Its effect upon the Far East is our present concern, and the well-nigh unanimous opinion of both natives and resident Europeans was that the war signified a body blow to white ascendancy. So profound an English student of the Orient as Meredith Townsend wrote, quote, it may be taken as certain that the victory of Japan will be profoundly felt by the majority of European states. With the exception of Australia, all European countries have implicated themselves in the great effort to conquer Asia, which has now been going on for two centuries, but which, as this author thinks, must now terminate. The disposition, therefore, to edge out intrusive Europeans from their Asiatic possessions is certain to exist even if it is not manifested in Tokyo, and it may be fostered by a movement of which, as yet, but little has been said. No one who has ever studied the question doubts that as there is a committee of Europe, so there is a committee of Asia, a disposition to believe that Asia belongs, of right, to Asiatics, and that any event which brings that right nearer to realization is to all Asiatics a pleasurable one. Japanese victories will give new heart and energy to all the Asiatic nations and tribes which now fret under European rule, will inspire in them a new confidence in their own power to resist, and will spread through them a strong impulse to avail themselves of Japanese instruction. It will take, of course, many years to bring this new force into play, but time matters nothing to Asiatics, and they all possess that capacity for complete secrecy which the Japanese displayed. End quote. That Meredith Townsend was reading the Asiatic mind aright seems clear from the pronouncements of Orientals themselves. For example, Buddhism, of Rangoon, Burma, a country of the Indochinese borderland between the yellow and brown worlds, expressed hopes for an Oriental alliance against the whites. Quote, "It would, we think," said his paper, "be no great wonder if a few years after the conclusion of this war saw the completion of a defensive alliance between Japan, China, and not impossibly Siam, the formulation of a new Monroe Doctrine for the Far East, guaranteeing the integrity of existing states against further aggression from the West. The West has justified, perhaps with some reason, every aggression on weaker races by the doctrine of the survival of the fittest, on the ground that it is best for future humanity that the unfit should be eliminated and give place to the most able race. That doctrine applies equally well to any possible struggle between Aryan and Mongolian. Whichever survives, should it ever come to a struggle between the two for world mastery, will, on their own doctrine, be the one most fit to do so. And if the survivor be the Mongolian, then is the Mongolian no peril to humanity, but the better part of it." The decade which elapsed between the Russo-Japanese and European wars saw in the Far East another event of the first magnitude, the Chinese Revolution of 1911. Toward the close of the 19th century, the world had been earnestly discussing the breakup of China. The huge empire, with its 400 million people, one-fourth of the entire human race, seemed at that time plunged in so hopeless a lethargy as to be foredoomed to speedy ruin. About the apparently moribund carcass, the eagles of the earth were already gathering, planning a partition of China analogous to the recent partition of Africa. The partition of China, however, never came off. The prodigious moral shock of the Japanese War roused China's elite to the imminence of their country's peril. First attempts at reform were blocked by the Dowager Empress, but her reactionary lurch ended in the Boxer Nightmare and the frightful Occidental chastisement of 1900. This time the lesson was learned. China was at least shaken, broad awake. The Bourbon Manchu court, it is true, wavered, but popular pressure forced it to keep the upward path. Every year after 1900 saw increasingly rapid reform. Reform, be it noted, not imposed upon the country from above, but forced upon the rulers from below. When the slow-footed Manchus showed themselves congenitally incapable of keeping step with the quickening national pace, the rising tide of national life overwhelmed them in the Republican Revolution of 1911, and they were no more. Even with the Manchu handicap, the rate of progress during those years was such as to amaze the wisest foreign observers. Quote, "Could the sage Confucius have returned a decade ago," wrote that old China hand W. R. Manning in 1910, "he would have felt almost as much at home as when he departed 25 years ago. Should he return a decade hence, he will feel almost as much out of place as Rip Van Winkle if the recent rate of progress continues." End quote. Toward the close of 1909, a close student of things Chinese, Harlan P. Beach, remarked, quote, "Those who, like myself, can compare the China of 25 years ago with the China of this year can hardly believe our senses." End quote. It was on top of all this that there came the revolution, a happening held by so sophisticated an observer as Dr. Dillon as, quote, "the most momentous event in 1,000 years, end quote. Whatever may have been the political blunders of the revolutionists, and they were many, the revolution's moral results were stupendous. The stream of Western innovation flowed at a vastly accelerated pace into every Chinese province. The popular masses were, for the first time, awakened to genuine interest in political, as distinguished from economic or personal, questions. Lastly, the semi-religious feeling of family kinship, which in the past had been almost the sole recognized bond of Chinese race solidarity, was powerfully supplemented by those distinctively modern concepts, national self-consciousness and articulate patriotism. Here was the Far Eastern situation at the outbreak of the Great War, a thoroughly modernized, powerful Japan, and a thoroughly aroused but still disorganized China. The Great War automatically made Japan supreme in the Far East, by temporarily reducing all the European powers to ciphers in Oriental affairs. How Japan proceeded to buttress this supremacy by getting a stranglehold on China, everyone knows. Japan's methods were brutal and cynical, though not a whit more so than the methods employed by white nations seeking to attain vital ends. and vital is precisely how Japan regards her hold over China. An essentially poor country with the teeming population, Japan feels that the exploitation of China's incalculable natural resources, a privileged position in the Chinese market, and guidance of Chinese national evolution in ways not inimical to Japan can alone assure her future. Japan's attitude towards her huge neighbor is one of mingled superiority and apprehension. She banks on China's traditional pacifism, yet she is too shrewd not to realize the explosive possibilities latent in the modern nationalist idea. As a Japanese publicist, Adachi Kenosuke remarks, quote, "The 20th century Genghis Khan threatening the sun flag with a Mongol horde armed with Krupp guns may possibly strike the Western sense of humor, but it is not altogether pleasing to contemplate a neighbor of 400 million population with modern armament and soldiers trained on the modern plan. The awakening of China means all this and a little more, which we of the present are not sure of." Japan cannot forget that between this nightmare of armed China and herself, there is only a very narrow sea, end quote. Certainly, young China has already displayed much of that unpleasant ebullience which usually accompanies nationalist awakenings. A French observer, Jean Rhodes, writes on this point, quote, "One of the things that most disquiet thinking men is that this new generation, completely neglecting Chinese studies while knowing nothing of Western science, yet convinced that it knows everything, will no longer possess any standard of values, national culture, or foreign culture. We can only await with apprehension the results of such ignorance, united with unbounded pride as characterized the Chinese youth of today." End quote. And another French observer, René Pignon, as far back as 1905, found the primary school children of Kangsu province chanting the following lines, quote, "I pray that the frontiers of my country become hard as bronze, that it surpass Europe and America, that it subjugate Japan, that its land and sea armies cover themselves with resplendent glory, that over the whole earth float the dragon standard, that the universal mastery of the empire extend and progress. May our empire, like a sleeping tiger, suddenly awakened, spring roaring into the arena of combat." End quote. Japan's masterful policy in China is thus unquestionably hazardous. Chinese national feeling is today genuinely aroused against Japan, and resentment over Japanese encroachments is bitter and widespread. Nevertheless, Japan feels that the game is worth the risk and believes that both Chinese race psychology and the general drift of world affairs combine to favor her ultimate success. She knows that China has in the past always acquiesced in foreign domination when resistance has proved patently impossible. She also feels that her aspirations for white expulsion from the Far East and for the winning of wider spheres of racial expansion should appeal strongly to yellow peoples generally, and to the Chinese in particular. To turn China's nascent nationalism into purely anti-white channels, and to transmute Chinese patriotism into a wider pan-Mongolism, would constitute a Japanese triumph of incalculable splendor. It would increase her effective force manyfold and would open up almost limitless vistas of power and glory. Nor are the Chinese themselves blind to the advantages of Chino-Japanese cooperation. They have an instinctive assurance in their own capacities. They know how they have ultimately digested all their conquerors, and many Chinese today think that from a Chino-Japanese partnership, no matter how framed, the inscrutable Sons of Han would eventually get the lion's share. Certainly, no one has ever denied the Chinaman's extraordinary economic efficiency. Winnowed by ages of grim elimination in a land populated to the uttermost limits of subsistence, the Chinese race is selected as no other for survival under the fiercest conditions of economic stress. At home, the average Chinese lives his whole life literally within a hand's breadth of starvation. Accordingly, when removed to the easier environment of other lands, the Chinaman brings with him a working capacity which simply appalls his competitors. That urbane celestial, Dr. Wu Tang Fang, well says of his own people, quote, "Experience proves that the Chinese, as all-around laborers, can easily outdistance all competitors. They are industrious, intelligent, and orderly. They can work under conditions that would kill a man of less hardy race, in heat that would kill a salamander, or in cold that would please a polar bear, sustaining their energies through long hours of unremitting toil with only a few bowls of rice. End quote. This Chinese estimate is echoed by the most competent foreign observers. The Australian thinker Charles H. Pearson wrote of the Chinese a generation ago in his epoch-making book, National Life and Character. Flexible as Jews, they can thrive on the mountain plateau of Tibet and under the sun of Singapore. More versatile than Jews, they are excellent laborers and not without merit as soldiers and sailors, while they have a capacity for trade which no other nation of the East possesses. They do not need even the accident of a man of genius to develop their magnificent future. End quote. And Lafcadio O'Hearn says, quote, a people of hundreds of millions, disciplined for thousands of years to the most untiring industry and the most self-denying thrift, under conditions which would mean worse than death for our working masses. A people, in short, quite content to strive to the uttermost in exchange for the simple privilege of life. End quote. This economic superiority of the Chinaman shows not only with other races, but with his yellow kindred as well. As regards the Japanese, John Chinaman has proved it to the hilt. Wherever the two have met in economic competition, John has won hands down. Even in Japanese colonies like Korea and Formosa, the Japanese, with all the backing of their government behind them, have been worsted. In fact, Japan itself, so bitter at white refusals to receive her immigrants, has been obligated to enact drastic exclusion laws to protect her working classes from the influx of Chinese cheap labor. It seems, therefore, a just calculation when Chinese estimate that Japanese triumphs against white adversaries would inure largely to China's benefit. After all, Chinese and Japanese are fundamentally of the same race and culture. They may have their very bitter family quarrels, but in the last analysis, they understand each other and may arrive at surprisingly sudden agreements. One thing is certain, both these overpopulated lands will feel increasingly the imperious need of racial expansion. For all these reasons, then, the present political tension between China and Japan cannot be reckoned as permanent, and we would do well to envisage the possibility of close Chinese cooperation in the ambitious program of Japanese foreign policy. The Japanese program looks first to the prevention of all further white encroachment in the Far East by the establishment of a Far Eastern Monroe Doctrine, based on Japanese predominance and backed, if possible, by the moral support of other Far Eastern peoples. The next stage in Japanese foreign policy seems to be the systematic elimination of all existing white holdings in the Far East. Thus far, practically all Japanese appear to be in substantial agreement. Beyond this point lies a wide realm of aspiration ranging from determination to secure complete racial equality and freedom of immigration into white lands to imperialistic dreams of wholesale conquests and world domination. These last items do not represent the united aspiration of the Japanese nation, but they are cherished by powerful circles which, owing to Japanese oligarchical system of government, possess an influence over governmental action quite disproportionate to their numbers. Although Japanese plans and aspirations have broadened notably since 1914, their outlines were well defined a decade earlier. Immediately after her victory over Russia, Japan set herself to strengthen her influence all over Eastern Asia. Special efforts were made to establish intimate relations with other Asiatic peoples. The Asiatic students were invited to attend Japanese universities, and as a matter of fact did attend by the thousand, while a whole series of societies was formed, having for their object the knitting of close cultural and economic ties between Japan and specific regions like China, Siam, the Pacific, and even India. The capstone was a Pan-Asiatic Association founded by Count Okuma. Some of the facts regarding these societies, about which too little is known, make interesting reading. For instance, there was the Pacific Ocean Society, Tahaijoka, whose preamble reads in part, quote, for a century, the Pacific Ocean has been a battleground wherein the nations have struggled for supremacy. Today, the prosperity or decadence of a nation depends on its power in the Pacific. To possess the empire of the Pacific is to be the master of the world. As Japan finds itself at the center of that ocean, whose waves bathe its shores, it must reflect carefully and have clear views on Pacific questions. End quote. Equally interesting is the Indo-Japanese Association, whose activities appear somewhat peculiar in view of the political alliance between Japan and the British Empire. One of the first articles of its constitution, from Count Akuma's pen, by the way, reads, quote, "All men were born equal. The Asiatics have the same claim to be called men as the Europeans themselves. It is therefore quite unreasonable that the latter should have any right to predominate over the former." End quote. No mention is made anywhere in the document of India's political connection with England. In fact, Count Akuma, in the autumn of 1907, had this to say regarding India. Quote, "Being oppressed by the Europeans, the 300 million people of India are looking for Japanese protection. They have commenced to boycott European merchandise. If, therefore, the Japanese let the chance slip by and do not go to India, the Indians will be disappointed. From old times, India has been a land of treasure. Alexander the Great obtained there treasure sufficient to load 100 camels, and Mahmud and Attila both obtained riches from India. Why should not the Japanese stretch out their hands toward that country, now that the people are looking to the Japanese? The Japanese ought to go to India, the South Ocean, and other parts of the world." End quote. In 1910, Putnam Whale, a competent English student of Oriental affairs, asserted, quote, "It can no longer be doubted that a very deliberate policy is certainly being quietly and cleverly pursued. Despite all denials, it is a fact that Japan has already a great hold in the schools and in the vernacular newspapers all over Eastern Asia, and that the gospel of Asia for the Asiatics is being steadily preached not only by her schoolmasters and her editors, but by the merchants and peddlers and every other man who travels." End quote. Exactly how much these Japanese propagandist efforts accomplished is impossible to say. Certain it is, however, that during the years just previous to the Great War, the white colonies in the Far East were afflicted with considerable native unrest. In French Indochina, for example, revolutionary movements during the year 1908 necessitated reinforcing the French garrison by nearly 10,000 men, and though the disturbances were sternly repressed, fresh conspiracies were discovered in 1911 and 1913. Much sedition and some sharp fighting also took place in the Dutch Indies, while in the Philippines, the independence movement continued to gain ground. What the growing self-consciousness of the Far East portended for the white man's ultimate status in those regions was indicated by an English publicist, J.D. Welbley, who wrote shortly after the outbreak of the European War, quote, "With the aid of Western ideas, the Far East is far attaining a solidarity impossible under purely Oriental methods. The smug satisfaction expressed in the West at what is called the modernization of the East shows lack of wisdom or an ineffective grasp of the meaning of comparatively recent events in Japan, China, Eastern Siberia, and even in the Philippines. In years past, the solidarity of the Far East was largely in point of view, while in other matters, powerful nations of the West played the game according to their own rules. Today, the solidarity of mental outlook still maintains, while in addition, there is rapidly coming about a solidarity of political and material interests, which in time will reduce Western participation in Far Eastern affairs to that of a comparatively unimportant factor. It might truly be said that this point is already reached, and that it only needs an application of the test to prove to the world that the Far East would resent Western interference as an intolerable impertinence." End quote.
And that will do us for this week. We are still in chapter two, but that's where we'll pick up at for next Friday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, context of white supremacy. If folks would like to participate, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We have about a half hour, so we should have ample time if folks have comments, things you would like to share. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up Your line should be open. Feel free to chime in if you have commentary. I'll start with Mr. Demery Ford, just because I don't think we heard him the first time around.
Still on?
Oh.
Unmuted.
I had, think I was being heard for people listening online. Just some of the folks on the phone missed me. I muted my headset. Thank you, firefighter. I said, obviously, we just finished the second audio segment. We'll be here same time next week, 8 p.m. Eastern. We're still in Chapter 2, about midway Chapter 2, but that's what we'll pick up at next Friday. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. We have about a half hour for folks to share. Everybody who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. I said I will get Mr. Demery Ford because I don't think we heard from him during the first session. Mr. Demery Ford, did you have commentary?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. No, I wasn't present for the first session, but I had listened to parts of the book before, and I ordered the book that hadn't come in yet. But this is by far evidence of some of the most racist literature that I've ever heard in my life. And some of it is factual. You know, a lot of it is judgmental or, you know, overt racism, you know, within the titles and grouping people according to their color, and then all of the racial stereotypes that Europeans and white people have about non-white people. It's all present, you know, in the worst form, because he's blending in factual data, you know, and to try to confuse the issue and then validate his racist views. And it's, you know, when he was just talking about the yellow man, you know, I mean, that's racist right there. But then you grouping everybody together, Chinese, Japanese, the Tagalog people or Filipinos, people from Thailand, I guess Vietnamese, he's going to put everybody all in there together. They all, you know, it just shows that the bottom line is, if we could just all get together and realize that we have one common enemy, and that is the white people, the racist individuals, you know, everybody other than non-white, you know, is just creating all this chaos and terrorism in the world. And I'll mute my line. I was interested in hearing what other people have to say about this, but I think this is, you know, it's very constructive, because you can see that, you know, what extent, you know, this racism is all embedded into the literary history of the European concept. I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking the call, man.
Good to hear from you, Mr. Demery Ford. Other people, everybody else who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. If you had commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Go ahead, firefighter. I'll go after you.
Thank you, sir. It is a effort. Well, not an effort, but I'm listening on how the racist white man, of course, from the assistance of their females, on how they went about the means of forcing themselves on the people who are called Chinese, primarily the quote unquote English white man, in with the Japanese, the English migrant white man who came to this part of the world and then went to Japan in the late 1860s, I believe, with I believe the person that represented this race of white supremacy in the Northwestern Hemisphere was this white male by the name of Perry, Admiral Perry. I could be wrong, but I think the last name is correct. Matter of fact, John Wayne, of all people, actually did a movie on this particular encounter. And in turn, it resulted into the Japanese ended up coming over here to get their study, from colleges and universities. And they ended up later on being leaders in the 30s and the 40s, those people. They also, I'm listening to this white man giving credit to white people's means to destroy themselves and others. Japan, once they developed these techniques from the racist white supremacists, basically started using it on other non-white people, which sounds familiar because that's some of the same things that non-white black people do also on the same basis and in similar ways. Also, what I heard was it was the all out means to take control totally over Asia and, of course, utilize the resources for the point of using the resources, glory, fun. And as Mr. Fuller says, just fun in doing it. I got down here, I wrote down here as a note, interesting study the author had on non-white people, Chinese, Japanese. I think I already said that before, we had both studied. The Japanese became more advanced in the white man's technology. Therefore, temporarily, they dominated the Chinese. Japan, from my understanding, doesn't have a whole lot of natural resources anyway. So in order for them to duplicate what they studied and learned, they had to go other places in order to get that ore and the different resources. And China, being such a vast territory, they were able to accomplish that through the training from the races, which to me indicates in large words, deception, how deceiving they are, and to have non-white people fighting against one another. As I said, it was temporarily because then came about, as we know, the rise of Chairman Mao took care of that situation with the Japanese and a lot of other people that was bothering that part of the world. He also, it seemed as though that he either was indicating or predicting the Japanese involvement, which would end up being in what the racist white man called World War II. Because there was a lot of talk on Japan, cultivating the resources in order to be able to wage war, so to speak, in that part of the world. And that's all I have for right now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you. Brilliant observations to both the firefighter and Mr. Demery as well. This is very interesting. On page 11, he wrote
two paragraphs that I found telling, and then I'm going to just not read anything else, just kind of freestyle simply because it would be too much to read. But these two paragraphs I find to be very important. It's on page 11. He writes, "This exclusion policy was not a Chinese peculiarity. It was common to all the yellow people." Oh, matter of fact, before I even get into that, I have to say I agree with Mr. Demery. It is one of the most racist readings I've ever heard. When he used the term the yellows, that just did it for me. And it's like at the very beginning, when the narrator was reading it, he had said he started one particular sentence with the yellows, and it just blew my mind. I was like, wow. But then I thought about it, it's the 1920s. So, I mean, it was probably one of the most racist, overtly racist periods in the history of this country. So it made sense. But yeah, definitely I agree with him on that. So yes, to get to the reading, this starts as, "This exclusion policy was not a Chinese peculiarity. It was common to all the yellow peoples and was adopted spontaneously at about the same time. In China, Japan, Korea, and Indochina, the same reaction produced the same results. The yellow world instinctively felt the white man to be a destructive, dissolving influence on this highly specialized line of evolution, which it wished to maintain unaltered. For three centuries, the yellow world succeeded in maintaining its isolation. Then, in the middle of the last century, insistent white pressure broke down the barriers and forced yellow races into full contact with the outer world. At the moment, the opening of the Far East was hailed by white men with general approval. But of late years, many white observers have regretted this forcible dragging of reluctant races into the full stream of world affairs. As an Australian writer, J. Little Kelly, remarks, "We have erred grievously by prematurely forcing ourselves upon Asiatic races. The instinct of the Asiatic in desiring isolation and separation from other forms of civilization was much more correct than our praise for imposing our forms of religion, morals, and industrialism upon them. It is not race hatred nor even race antagonism that is at the root of this attitude. It is an unerring intuition which in years gone by has taught the Asiatic that his evolution in the scale of civilization could best be accomplished by his being allowed to develop on his own lines. Pernicious European compulsion led him to abandon that attitude. Let us not be ashamed to confess he was right and we were wrong." Now, what I find interesting about this is in both paragraphs, they talk about the insistent white pressure and pernicious European compulsion. And it kind of made me think of Henrietta Lacks and how the white terroristic author literally was so persistent in her haranguing Mrs. Lacks's relatives to give her access to her medical records, allow her into their homes, all of this stuff. And it just speaks to how white people will try every angle possible and put in the most intense pressure to break us down. And to me, that was one of the most telling things that they discussed there. I also find it interesting where he discusses later on in the chapter about a pan-Asian coming together where they turn against the white races. And I find that interesting because it's kind of what's happening now, because China is now bonding with Japan, and they're both now bonding with the Philippines. The Philippines just spoke about kicking the United States completely out of the military bases they have there in 2 years. So there's a lot of the things that Mr. Lathrop Stoddard is discussing. He's actually very predictive of a lot of things that we're starting to see come into play now. So I just find that to be very telling as far as him being such an intense and astute raised a student of human populations that he's able to actually predict something like that from back as early as the 1920s. I find that to be very telling. Thank you. And with that, I'll mute my line and give someone else a chance to speak.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Roz is 100% right. That whole paragraph, I'm not going to reread it, but that whole paragraph there, man, it was telling. I did take a couple notes. There was one part here where it said that the West has justified, perhaps with some reason, every aggression on weaker races by the doctrine of survival of the fittest on the ground that it is the best for future humanity, that the unfit should be eliminated and give place to the most able race. That, once again, just sounds like white people making the rules and determining who is supposed to be who when they didn't create the planet, taking that from Mr. Fuller. It's just very interesting how they, in everything that they do, they are literally, they think that they are qualified to make the decisions just because, they just because. It's just amazing that they even have that thought process. The other thing that I was thinking about, I'm not going to reread that paragraph that Roz was talking about, but in reference to them keeping themselves away, the Asians keeping themselves, doing their best to keep themselves away from white people. I have someone that I know, and I asked him about this because there was an article early in the year about, I believe, I think it was North Korea, and how they don't allow any search engines at all. No Google, no Yahoo, no nothing. No outside Western influence specifically. And so I asked this gentleman about it, and I said, well, would it be accurate to basically say that they don't want anything to do with white people or white culture? And this is, he's Korean, and he said that is 100% white. He said they don't say it like that, but, you know, he said that's 100% white. And I also asked him, when they're doing this kind of, when they're doing the censorship, are they thinking about black people or just white people? And he specifically said, no, this is just white people, man. He said black people are an afterthought. And I just find reading this information, and then I remember having that conversation with him, just specifically how even back then in the 20s, people knew the destructive nature of white supremacy and how they were just literally doing their best to stay away from it. But as Roz had said, the immense amount of pressure, political and every area of activity, as Mr. Fuller said, is that eventually they're just going to try to get you to bow. And I, like I said, I just found that very, very interesting. You know, this is extremely racist material, but, you know, you can learn a lot from different things, and I'm learning a lot. So that's I mean, my mind.
Other folks that we have not heard from have commentary? We didn't miss anybody? Anybody who has a hand up that we have not heard from the second time around? I will assume, folks, we got everybody, at least for the time being. We should have a few more minutes if folks have comments they want to get in before we get ready to wrap the broadcast up. Some of the notes that I took that I thought were significant. First, for the person who commented before and saying that they thought Mary Lefkowitz might be a comparison, the only I just wanted to make sure I was not confusing. The only point that I raised was I do think it's important that we keep in mind the popularity of Lothrop Stoddard. I think I said that a few times before. Just these folks were not thought of in the way of a Donald Trump or an Ann Coulter, the way people would think of them today is, at least publicly, I think you would get a sizable portion of whites who would say, oh yeah, these guys are terrible, and I totally disagree with them. That's not the perception. These were like popular, respected academics in the early 20th century. That's it. Some of the things that I picked out from the second audio segment, the portion where it referenced Stoddard was talking about the Japanese, their military success, as though these were highly intelligent children, where he does the quote, I think the female caller mentioned before about the selective quoting. But this notion, I think that's why Mr. Fuller, where he says you cannot be a victim of racism and qualified to be a woman or a man, racists certainly do not think of you as being an adult if you are subject to white supremacy. The next portion, when they talked about, and I thought that was really interesting, the Mel, who helped edit the audio, where she said, taking a class and covering some Asian history, that they didn't really talk about the Russo-Japanese War of 1904, that they just focused on a lot of the conflict, non-white people in some sort of conflict with another non-white group. I thought that was really important, but the passage where it says, the echoes of that yellow triumph over one of the great white powers reverberated to the ends of the earth and started obscure strains of consequences even
today, not yet fully disclosed. I think that's just really important. Number one, I think the caller mentioned before the commentary about Russia and are they really white, and maybe they are white, but they're less powerful. At the end of the day, if you are part of the white race, it's all in. We might fight and squabble and argue amongst each other, but we are all in. We're down, particularly if it's got something to do with niggers, and they're fighting and making sure we maintain white domination worldwide, universally, really. We will be all in. I thought that was really important, just showing the global Voltron effect, something we've talked about before. I thought right next from that paragraph where he continues, with the exception of Austria, all European countries have implicated themselves in the greater effort to conquer Asia, which has now been going on for two centuries, but which, as this author thinks, must now terminate. I thought that was really important. Again, you get the Voltron effect, and just, I don't think you hear as frequently now this sort of explicit admission of coordinated white efforts, particularly on an international level, to dominate and sabotage black people. You hear people talk about this in relation to Haiti sometimes, and I would say not even that often when they do that, and it's more so in a historical sense, but you might hear this sort of thing with Haiti. You might hear a little of this if you go back and dig about South Africa and what they were doing to deal with quote-unquote apartheid way back when, but you just generally don't hear this type of open admission of coordinated white efforts to maintain white supremacy, which is, I think, one of the reasons Dr. Welsing recommended this text. Let's see. The next, after the first audio segment, we had a caller who talked about whether or not the 1895 conference where they divide up the continent, whether that would be mentioned in the book. And he does briefly talk about it, where he says about the apparently moribund carcass, the eagles of the earth were already gathered planning a partition of China analogous to the recent partition of Africa, but they don't go into any more detail than that. Apparently, Negroes are not worthy of even more than a sentence of mention at this point in the book. Let's see. And I think we talked about this before in terms of the importance. I know Dr. Welsing talked about this on this program. Non-white people having black self-respect and not squabbling, arguing with each other, that is something that would totally devastate the system of white supremacy, and really making sure that we are not in conflict with other victims. Where he talks about to envisage the possibility of close Chinese cooperation in the ambitious program of Japanese foreign policy, and how disastrous that would be for the white race to see China and Japan cooperating. I just think that is worldwide with any groups of non-white people, where it looks like they're starting to cooperate, work together, and realize that their enemy is white man. Massive escalation in tactics, terrorism, everything that is so integral to the system staying together, having victims in conflict with each other. Also thought the caller, I think it was a female caller during the first audio segment, where she said that, she can set me straight if I'm wrong, but I think she said that racists, their tendency is to view us and think that we are going to be thinking in the same manner as racists. That we have the same way, the same mentality, the same viewpoint, the same ambitions as racists. In the passage where he says, beyond this point lies a wide realm of aspiration ranging from determination to secure complete racial equality and freedom of immigration into white lands to imperialistic dreams of wholesale conquests and world domination. Dominion, sorry. Just anything has to be a sign of, oh my gosh, the Negroes, the dark people, they're trying to take over the world, they're trying to do what we did. I think you hear that sort of fear on a regular basis, that somehow racist not only is there, somehow non-white people, their goal is not just to be quote-unquote equal with us or to end racism, but to dominate us and do what we have done to them, to get some sort of revenge. We hear that I hear that on a pretty regular basis from whites, 1920, 2016. I will stop there. Do we have any other folks who had comments, anything in particular stand out, anything significant folks want to make sure they get in before the end of the first segment?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, mentioned about the partition of China, when it says it's analogous to the partition of Africa. But then the sentence said the partition of China, however, never came. And it's interesting because they started to refer to the Boxers' Rebellion and this partitioning of Africa, because what they did with the Boxers' Rebellion, too, was, and you were talking about coalitions of white nations coming in trying to colonize a country. That's what happened with the Boxers' Rebellion. You know, you had Germany, you had England, you had Russia, you had United States trying to come in under the banner of Christianity. And you know, when I used to study the Boxers' Rebellion, I'm like, where did I hear that from? Oh yeah, Africa. Same thing that they did with Africa. They tried to come under the banner of Christianity for colonial takeover. However, the Chinese, even though they lost, you know, they were more stringent against the white supremacy. And to this day, this is why Christianity is not welcomed so openly in China, because of what happened during that time. So when I was reading about that, it kind of immediately popped in my mind about that. And for those who, you know, I mean, we all know that this is a racist text by a racist man, but wait until you get to the chapter when he talks about black people. It gets very deep there. So I'll mute my line.
Right on. The Berlin Conference, where they partitioned Africa, is 1884 and 1885. Just making sure I get accurate information for that as well. I was going to ask, exactly what do we think he meant when he said, when he's talking about the regions of Western Europe, how they were sufficiently Nordicized? What does that mean exactly? That might be one people can think about and prepare next week. If folks want to respond briefly before we wrap up this week, that's fine too. But that was one question that came to mind. He talked a lot about that in the first audio segment. Anything else folks want to make sure they get in? Your line is a little low. I'm just double checking with the caller, make sure we didn't miss anybody totally. I'll get you as well, sir. 4757, did you have a comment? Then I'll come back and get Ramon as well. 4757.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, this is Mel again. I wanted to echo my partner's thoughts, actually, on what the last caller said when we were going through the editing and stuff like that. And he pointed out that it seemed like the last caller said that white supremacists seem to recycle their tactics, basically from one white supremacist, well, from one non-white group to another non-white group, with the Christianity. And also that to say people should really tune in next week when we get to Brown Man's Land, because the way he talks about us is just wow. Oh, wait, no, we're black man's land. Wait, sorry, going too far ahead. So I wanted to point out on the last sentence on page 29 refers to an Asian doctor by the phrase urbane celestial. I had never heard this in a literature before, but it's my understanding that that's a racial slur along with Chinaman and Oriental. The book also, I feel like overall, but definitely so far, seems to have reinforced the idea that non-white people have no history of any kind of value worth investigating morality-wise or just and what they were doing with the wars among themselves before white people interacted with them. Like, the book starts with non-white people at wars with white people. The Russo-Japanese War, China's conflict with white people, India's rebellions against white people. And that it also seems to not really say that non-white people gave white people anything of value. Some people could argue we say mass. I mean, the very important invention of gunpowder is from I don't think they mentioned that at all at this point in the text. I wanted to also point out page 29, so interesting, the part where it's a Chinese writer who is talking about Chinese people. He's quoted as saying that they can outlast heat that would kill a salamander or in cold that would feed the polar bear, sustaining their energy through long hours of unremitting toil with only a few bowls of rice. And then he follows that with a white writer who's also talking about the Chinese, who says They do not need even the accident of a man of genius to develop their magnificent future. And I think that white supremacists used to see Asian people, possibly still, as kind of like hardy people, almost kind of like black people, but not quite as hardy. They can outlast, they can do anything, which is why they kind of have them working all the laundries and all the railroads, along with black people, mind you, prior to 1900, I think up until about 1950 at least. And that was all my comments. Thank you.
Appreciate it, Mel, our editor, her partner, doing the grand narration for Lothrop Stoddard's work. Ramon, were you going to comment, sir?
Yes, sir, Gus. Thank you. Gus, I was wanting to know, as I keep reading deeper into these histories of so-called white, are we talking about a color? Because according to a lot of people that come out of Europe, white is not a color. And as I continue to read into the history of Irish people, it describes them as a simian race, which is mulatto. And I'm starting to ask this question as we keep reading this book. Is this guy talking truly about the skin color, or is he talking about European people as a whole, which could be black people in color or pigmentation? That's my question. And I don't know if it could be answered tonight, but it concerns me because I keep hearing white. I never hear pigmentation so much more than I hear white. And it's been documented in many of people who have come from Europe, even in modern times, said when they came to America as immigrants, they were, as black people, they were forced to mark white on their census. And I'll mute my line.
It might be, we're kind of at the end of the day, so it might be something you want to kind of bring up as we move through the text and see, you know, kind of the way he's using the terms as we move through. I just think it's really important to keep in mind all of this is loosely, very loosely, based around melanin and skin pigmentation. At the end of the day, what we're talking about, this is a political classification, the classification of white. And at its core, at its essence, what we're talking about is mistreating, terrorizing all of the people that we say are not white, particularly the people that we say are black. That's what it's about at the end of the day, loosely, very loosely, based around color. You do not have anyone who has, quote-unquote, white skin. You just have people who identify with a political classification that uses the term white. To make it clear that we are about mistreating people, and particularly mistreating people that are dark, and we're just going to say that we are white, even though our skin is not white either, if that makes sense. But again, that's something I think if you kind of pay attention as we move through the text, just to see how words are used, and if that makes more sense as we move through the text. We did our 3 hours. Certainly, folks, if you all have questions, comments, observations as we move through the text we just started, you can drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have something that you want to read as we move through the text, we can do that also. The compensatory call-in will be here tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Tune in, we will catch up on observations from the past 7 days. We will also be here next Wednesday. That'll be earlier just because we have a guest joining us from the continent. If you have, again, any questions, guest suggestions, gripes, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll catch folks in about 24 hours. As I state consistently, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, particularly if you're going to be in a vehicle. You do not know when you will have a day where you bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any other race soldier, badge or no. Whites are dangerous. We should really strive to make sure that our behavior at all times reflects the fact that war is being waged against us. We should make sure that we are always able to make the best possible decisions to keep ourselves as safe as
possible. I do not think sobriety, I do not think being under the influence of anything, alcohol, cannabis, cigarettes, any other narcotics, I don't think any of that has proven to aid our ability to replace white supremacy with justice. That's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
no
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.